James is an oxymoron. And I am the crown prince of charisma, Mo, but the star of the show is the man who is the king of the con and the master of the scam, I guess we'll say, Joe Mo.
Whatever, it's the second show. We've got time to actually build up into a nickname.
That's right. Well, I give myself a nickname because, you know, that's how we do it up here.
We could go by the nickname my father told me as a child.
Well, what's that?
Unwanted. Yeah, but this show is all about bringing the man, the myth, the soon-to-be legend, Tyler James.
That's right. That's
into
right.
Into the fold.
You know, Tyler James is a very, very special guest in this episode, a man who is the publisher of Comics Drive, as well as the writer of The Red Tan. What else? Epic we got here. Oxymoron, of course. The master and commander of all he surveys. A man that Joe Mulvey, every time I talk to him, calls a genius in the world of comic books and a bastard from Boston, and seems to be completely sincere when saying both of these things. Tyler James, how are you?
I'm doing great, guys. It's an honor to be on your second show, and I apologize if you guys don't make it to a third.
But, and of course, we do.
It's good to be on here and talk to my We Talk podcast fans. How many podcasts you guys got now? Pretty much there's nothing on the internet you don't talk about.
We talk syrup. We talk caramel.
Well, we talk syrup. we talk maple syrup. We're Canadian.
Yeah. We talk cheddar. It's huge.
Oh, I love cheese.
We talk luge or the various luge specials.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I can't wait for the three-parter coming up.
Oh, yeah. And talk about that for 6 hours. All right. We also got the man who puts the cub in reporter. Keith, how are you doing?
I am also here.
You're also here, crashing the party, and always welcome to. So that's right. It's I don't know. It's going to be a fun show here. I mean, it's going to be chaos, but it's going to be a fun show. But
Keith is the voice of reason. Keith is the one that keeps us on track.
Yeah. Well, we're fucked. But anyway, so we're going on here. I want to get back a little bit into the beginnings of Comics Tribe here. Tyler. Very first book published through Comics Tribe was what?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I've been creating comics since I was about 13. Little staple jobs that I photocopied in my dad's office, but about 2.5-3 years ago, I really started getting involved in a lot of collaborative projects and. I'd be writing and working with other artists to bring stories to life, and so an imprint was necessary. And at the same time, I've been working with a guy named Steve Forbes, and we're both writing our own articles and things just about the process of creating comics and things we're learning doing stuff. And we sort of wanted to bring everything under one umbrella, and that umbrella came to be Comics Tribe. Which launched the beginning of last year. So
it wasn't really launched. It wasn't launched just for you to do your own book. It wasn't like, I got my own stuff, I'm going to launch that, and then people came to you after.
No, the intention was always to have it be both a platform for the creative, collaborative work that I was doing with other people, but to, if that went well and we didn't crash and burn in the beginning, to also be a platform that people that sort of are liking what we're putting out and on both the resource and the creator resource side, but also the publishing side, that, you know, if that attracts certain people that seem to be people that we want to work with, then we may have some publishing solutions and options there. And so that was sort of the case with Joe and Scam. I really respected what Joe was doing with his outreach and trying to get people into comics. And as it turned out, he had a comic of his own. And the more we got talking about it, the more I said, hey, you know, I think Comics Tribe and what we're learning with trying to get the Red Ten out to people and other books and other things, I think we can apply some of that to Scam and make some magic happen. And Joe is just enough of a sucker to take me at my word.
Huh. Absolutely.
It's true. He calls me sucker and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
On the phone, in emails. Hey, sucker. Hey, stupid. What you doing?
So it really is like a big brother type relationship.
Yeah, yeah. Except, you know, I don't know how it runs in Canada. A lot less sodomy.
A lot less sodomy.
It's more, yeah, it's more professional.
So not as much fun. Yeah.
Right, no, right.
Yeah, okay. So there's...
equal amount syrup.
All right, Tyler. So you're sitting there. You hear. That's how you hear about Joe the first time, through this outreach.
You know, it's kind of hard to even go back. I'd have to go back through the email number chain and Twitter and everything. That's one of the great things about creating nowadays is that, you know, you can strike up relationships with people through podcasts, through Twitter and social media and just, you know, blog conversations and stuff. So, but then it sometimes becomes hard to say, you know, I feel like I've known this person for forever, but how exactly did that come about? It's not always the easiest thing to come back to. But yeah, I think we just got to talking, and you know, I really liked what he was doing with Scam, and you know, Joe definitely had the opportunity to bring it to a bunch of different publishers, but it was something that, you know, I think he wanted to work with us on. So we're grateful for that, because it's been a huge book for us, sort of putting it on the map, and we learned a lot of things with our micro distribution push, and now I'm learning a ton more things using Scam as our direct market diamond worldwide distribution guinea pig. So,
offense to any Italian,
has been a hell of a partner for that. So yeah.
I mean, it's got to be good to have a guy out there who's got no shame in promoting himself. And Lord knows that's Joe.
Shame is definitely
way
too many Koreans.
So, okay, so the very first time, you know, you're talking to him, his emails, very first time when's the first time you met him in person or talked to him on the phone? What are you thinking?
Hold on 1 second. Is this turning into a Joe Mulvey, This Is Your Life? Because if my third grade teacher that I think saw my boner comes on the podcast, this is going to be amazing.
Yeah, you know what? And he did see your boner.
It was a woman, for God's sakes.
No, but I thought you said that your teacher gave you a boner. So I assumed
she used to play the flute. What can I say? It just connected.
Fuck. All right, Tyler. So very first time you talked to Joe, what the hell are you thinking to yourself?
Well, My Cousin Vinny was my favorite movie of all time. So, I immediately felt at home. having a conversation with Joe. But no, in all seriousness, I mean, the first time we got together and met in person was New York Comic Con, and you know, I'm coming directly to the guy's house, and we're shooting off to that massive mecca of pop culture geekness.
Wait a second, use the expression "shooting off to that"?
Got together and shooting off. Yeah.
You expect me to just let that go, huh?
You would not be the radio icon that you are if you did. So
yeah, that's right. Keep that in mind.
I'm just gonna keep letting them setting them up, and you know, knock them out of the park there. Or I don't even know what you guys play in Canada.
We'll knock it out of the ice rink.
There you go.
We will curl it right out of the where do we curl to again?
I don't know. Curling. I don't know. It's stupid. And I'm Canadian and I'm saying that. Man, what the hell is
that? Is it an end?
I don't know.
Is that big up there? It can't be.
Yeah, seriously, dude. You have no idea. The damn thing takes over. This curling takes over twice.
It's literally sweeping. But you're not even sweeping ice.
I know. Trust.
It's like sweeping in the cemetery. There's fucking dirt everywhere. Why would you sweep?
I know.
I'm sorry.
Especially
let's get back to the point. Let's get back to the point at hand. Me and Tyler, we're at New York Comic Con. Go. All
right. So you guys are at New. Is that where you first met him in person, Joe?
Yeah. So yeah, I believe so.
What do you think? Okay. So what do you think when you first meet Tyler, and Tyler contacts you, and you're like, "This is a great thing"? Are you a little skeptical, or what's going on there?
I don't know, but I mean, the relationship took off pretty quickly, where it was a comfortability factor, an honesty factor. And like I said, I'm fucking – until I – you know, I'm loyal to Tyler and to Comics Tribe till the day I die. I'm a big loyalty guy, and you know, he saw promise stuff, and to me, that means the world. So the guy gets my dollar. I don't know if I want to say that, but the guy gets my my effort every single time.
Slurp, slurp, slurp. He is your boss. Wow. Jesus. But that's all right. That's all right. Don't you have anything bad to say about him? I have lots of bad shit to say about Keith.
Yeah, I'm Boston. Oh. But he's really actually from the Albany area, so that is New York. So, you know, it's okay.
It's all right then. Well, then, yeah, no, all of a sudden I like him more. Yeah.
True.
Yeah.
Well, by default, Mo, you're actually my boss, so you should be looking for Tyler to say bad things about Mulvey.
Oh, there you go.
And let me just say this. When you have conned with a person several times, that, especially business-wise and personal-wise, that's like jumping 20 steps each time in friendship, because you're like 20 hours behind a table, not to count the ridiculous countless hours and weeks and months beforehand for preparation. So like, that's a real crash course, and I'm either going to fucking want to kill this person at the end of a four-day con thing, or I still want to hang out with the guy. He's good people. So once you come out of that as, I still want to hang out, collaborate, talk, and do business, then I think you're better off, because being at a con can really test a relationship.
Yeah, it's the equivalent of like the weekend getaway with the new girlfriend or boyfriend, only a lot less
sexual.
Not as,
you know, I'm just gonna leave that one alone too. Like, it's just no effort there.
There's too many
there. So yeah, a lot less sexual. Yeah.
But it's been a good working relationship since.
There you go. Yeah, all right. That's Vietnam or honeymoon. You basically make them sound like about the same thing. Basically, yeah.
Tell me I'm wrong.
All right, so who else comes on board then Comics Tribe in the early days to help you out, Tyler?
Well, over at the site, Steve Forbes is sort of the co-creator of Comics Tribe. He writes two columns a week and is working behind the scenes editing just about everything we put out and just doing a bang up job with that. So he's been pivotal on a lot of these books. John Lees is the writer of The Standard, and he definitely has been an asset to the tribe.
He's always been very active on your website doing reviews and that type of thing. So
yeah, he's a phenom. Yeah. John Lee's a Scottish phenom. Yeah. I'll say it right now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's his, I reread, I'm like the only, I think I'm the only person on American soil that has a copy of the first volume of The Standard, The Trade. And I reread that this weekend, and you know, the guy is phenomenal. He's starting to get some acclaim for it. And my job is to figure out how the hell I can get the American mainstream audience to give this book the chance that it needs and really blow it up. And so we're hoping that with the success of Scam and the Red 10 going through the direct market and through Diamond, that we can continue to build up that Comics Tribe name, and then, you know, relaunched, give it the proper direct market push of The Standard, all six issues, pump them out monthly, and get John get his star rising, and Jonathan Rector, the artist, on there as well.
I can't wait. That's awesome, because I seriously got to read that, because I just thought The Standard was phenomenal. But I am wondering, so you're sitting there going, okay, we're going to release that third, because we're hoping to gain a little momentum from Scam, and we don't want to release this first because we don't want people to miss it. Is that essentially kind of what you're saying was your strategy with The Standard?
It's part of it. The challenge with The Standard is the hook is not it's not as immediately sellable it's not a tweet, you know. It's not like Scam has a very, very easy, very high concept pitch immediately.
Yeah.
And Red 10, similar issue. But in a tension deficit or society where, you know, it's tough to get retailers are bombarded with, you know, AVX, Marvel Now, this, that, and the other, New 52. Like, the last thing that they're doing is looking for new superhero stuff. So we kind of have to come at them from a different angle. But man, like I've said it before, but I'll say it again. Like, the Standard number 3 is the best superhero book I've read this year, and I can't wait to actually let everybody else see that and read it and recognize that the genius that is John Lee's.
You know, I'm sorry, I spaced out on what you were saying. Something about attention deficit.
exactly.
Missed that.
Sorry, I was reading before Watchmen. If you could go back.
Yeah. Well, no, the Standard.
Let me tell you something. About John Lee's, let me just say this one thing. It is guys like him that when they finally, that star rises, like Tyler keeps saying, and they succeed, it's because they truly are just talented and enthusiastic people. If you meet him in real life, John Lee's, writer of The Standard, is as much a complete comic book fan. I mean, process of making comic books, collecting comic books, creators behind comics. John Lee's is what I would consider to be probably just one of the most enthusiastic people for comics that I've ever met in the history of my life, and I'd be willing to bet the history of a lot of other people's lives. He's amazing.
No one had a better New York Comic Con than John Lee's. Like, I'm positive no one enjoyed themselves as much as that Scottish bastard.
It's true.
He got, like, he had like 5 times the con I had, just like spent the same amount of time, but, you know, every time, all right, he's getting up, he's getting, you know, his favorite artist, he's getting books signed by Scott Snyder, he's meeting Jason Aaron, getting sketches from, you know, his favorite artists left and right, coming back, selling twice as many books as me and Joe are selling, getting up again, running around, going, seeing panels. The dude was just on fire, and it was so
awesome. And Tyler will back this up. He sold one of our entire packages, which was all our books, a print, this, that, and the other, to a cosplayer Batman who had nothing but a utility belt, no way to carry the items. He was in complete latex, and that Scotsman sold him a ton of stuff to carry for the rest of the con.
You know what?
Unbelievably impressive.
I do want to meet him. I am worried if I meet him, he'll be eating haggis. That's, you know, that was...
Listen to me. I wouldn't even worry about that. If you meet him, it's almost like you want to take him home.
Right.
You just want to get him and put him in a box.
Yeah, I've had maybe that's situation. Maybe that's the next thing you guys need to sell is a John Lee's, like a little doll that you can put in a box. Marketable?
You know what? We might have to edit this out because that does have a ring to it. I like it. As soon as you open the box, it goes, "Have you checked out Comic Strip? Hello. Have you? Yeah. And that was the thing. People didn't understand what he was saying. And when they leaned in, he grabbed their arm and brought them over to the table. He's like, "Oh, hello. You're welcome to New York Comic Con. Thank you so much for my name, Shane. I'm from Nevada." And all of a sudden, people are like, "What?"
Sorry.
And then he goes, "Yeah, next thing you know, they're buying 10 copies of Scam, 5 copies of this, 10 copies of that." He's amazing.
You know, I'm gonna.
I was a car dealer in Scotland. I would pick him up in a second.
Gonna go off on a tangent here. I remember years ago, I was working for my dad. He used to do construction, and he had brought this plumber guy in, right? So this plumber goes in.
I don't like this going.
You don't like it already? No. He brings this plumber, and his plumber's got 2 assistants, right? And they're talking to each other, and they're off in the corner, and I don't know. They're like these 2 guys. They're like white guys, and I can't understand a damn word. I think they're like Russian or something like that. I'm listening to them. I don't know. I worked with them for a week, right? And then I was kind of listening kind of closely one day, and I heard all this swearing, right? I'm like, fucking, and I'm like, they're speaking English. I asked them where they're from, and it said Scotland. I thought it was Russian. Like, if it wasn't for the cursing, I never would have figured out that they were actually speaking the same language as me.
But it's funny because, like, you know, and we're getting off here on a tangent, but I knew a Russian guy that used to go to my gym, and this is 100% true story. He used to talk to me like, every bad Dan Aykroyd, Chevy Chase, Russian accent that you ever heard. So he was this big, burly guy. He kind of looked like the guy from Street Fighter, except not with the mohawk, but he had the beard, and he was just a brick shithouse. And he used to just talk all the time, and I could never understand him. And then finally, after like 6 months of seeing him, I could kind of understand him, to where he would search me out every single time I went to the gym. And the one time he did, he comes up to me, and I was with my wife at the time. We were just dating. She came to work out, and he goes, hey, Joe, listen to this shit. I'm like, what's going on? He goes, I take out that girl, right, this week. I take her out. I buy her salad. I buy her meat. I go to movie. No fuck sex for me. Yet. Nothing. I'm like, all right, dude. I'm like, this is my friend. It's my friend Joy, who ends up now being my wife. I'm like, you could have told me that in privacy. He goes, no. We talk later. And I'm like, it's unbelievable, because I feel like I'm being racist with my slang, and this is what the man said.
That's excellent. That is excellent.
So don't feel bad. Accents are confusing.
There you go. Any good accents or Russian stories for either one of you two? There, Tyler or Keith?
I can't top that. I just want to know later if Joe if Joe got lucky later tonight.
Yeah, did you, like, come did on, you buy our McDonald's and get some?
I bought your meat.
I bought the meat. I bought her salad. No fuck sex for me. Yet. Nothing.
Seriously, at the end of the day, do you turn to your now wife and go, look, I obviously bought you dinner, and you know how this is supposed to go now, bitch. Like,
My wife knows by the time the check comes, my pants are off. I don't care where we are. If we're at Sizzler, if we're at, a nice Ruth Chris steakhouse, it doesn't matter. If I don't see her credit card going on that table, I expect comeuppance.
No, I tell you the truth. That's how I enter a restaurant. And it doesn't matter if I'm with a woman or not.
Let me tell you something. You are Peter Griffin. I can understand that. I guess. Just getting naked for no reason. Fantastic.
Excellent. Keith, have you got anything to add to this shit? Or are you just sitting there listening and enjoying?
Listening and enjoying.
But no, as we were saying, to get back on track, the Standard is an unbelievable book, and that is hopefully another thing that will just boost the entire Comics Tribe publishing line.
Well, you know what? It's very much true that, I mean, the best thing that can happen for Comics Tribe is multiple high-quality books, and that's what we've seen. I mean, we got the Standard, as we talked about, Scam. And it doesn't totally suck. You're welcome.
That's all. That's the quote we need for the book.
There's the full quote right there.
The Red 10. I mean, we got the first two issues of the Red 10. Again, it's one of those ones where I can't wait. So let's talk about the next big thing, though, from Comics Tribe, the book. I mean, I know it's also going to be awesome. Now, I'm looking over here. I'm on Kickstarter. I'm on the Kickstarter for Oxymoron. Now, first off, your picture, Tyler, you look this picture you got here, and you use it on Twitter. Whereas Joe, his Twitter picture, he looks like, I don't know, like he's, at his bar mitzvah or something. But you look scary, man. What the hell? Fixing a smile or something. What are you doing there? You look like, basically, actually, when I look at Oxymoron, I think if you put that makeup on, you would look like the psycho killer.
I was actually the model for, there was a close-up of the Oxymoron biting into a piece of human flesh. For my short, and I was the own model for it. So
I could see that. I could see that.
You got that forward too. But you know what? Don't worry, Keith, because if we raise another $1,000, that unlocks new headshots for me. So pledge Oxymoron Kickstarter. Get on it.
Beautiful. Well, that'll get it another $25. But anyways, okay, let's talk a little bit about it here. You put it up, what, about 2 weeks ago now? You're about halfway through. You've had good success. But it looks like you had a lot of people who've been very generous, certainly, but you want more backers, more people to see it, get the word out, and see more people to take a look at what you're doing here, obviously, right?
Oh, exactly. We want it to go as high as it possibly can go. And, one of the things that from a design of the campaign itself, that was a goal of mine, was that once we hit our minimum goal to actually make the book feasible, everything above that is all about let's make this product or this and the offer and the incentives like as good as they can get. So, we just unlocked some additional incentives, bookmarks for everybody, and and at 10K, and then at 12.5, there's a just gorgeous CP Wilson mini print that now everybody $20 or more is getting. And the big one we're trying to unlock at 15K is we're going to go from a standard sized hardcover to one of those oversized Walking Dead style hardcovers. We've got more stuff that if the fundraising gets to a certain point, it makes certain things more things feasible. So yeah, we're trying to sell as many books as possible. You know, my goal is to get as much exposure as I can for all of all the great talent that's on this book. So and Kickstarter just seemed like a no-brainer for to hit that. So
yeah, you know, you got so much cool design stuff and so many packages here. The Joe Mulvey Commission. What's that, Joe?
It's me pretty much drawing whatever the hell you want. And unfortunately, it's sold out. They might open up again, though. Who knows? Just got to keep pledging. I might even come to your house and do it. I'll do it in person.
Yeah. You can get Tyler James in person, right, Tyler?
Yes, you can.
That's right. I will come to your shop, library, school, cardboard box, wherever you want to bring me. That's another one of the pledge levels that's up there. We've got all kinds of good stuff.
You do. The shirts are cool as hell. I'm just kind of peeking through it here while we're talking here. Some of the cool stuff you've put up. How much have you drawn of? You ever drawn? I'm sure there's got to be an oxymoron by you out there, Joe.
Me? Yeah, absolutely. There's an oxymoron I did actually a little while ago at a show, and then I have the various oxymoron things I've done for the actual book. Okay. So
yeah, let's get into the concept of the book. Tyler, explain it to us.
So oxymoron is a psychopath who is obsessed with contradiction, and he was Red 10 fans know that he's definitely our Joker analog as the nemesis from our, you know, detective character, who's the titular character of the Red 10. The conceit behind it is that a lot of his crimes are contradiction based and things that, about the world and life's many hypocrites and stuff are things that drive him absolutely insane. He's a very active active at rectifying them in often dastardly and deviant ways. So, he's sort of in the Red 10. At least for the first couple chapters, it appears he's more of a patsy than the architect of things there. But this collection is really a chance to flesh out the character more, and so. I knew just from the reaction that the Red 10 got and commission requests for, you know, that guy that looks like the cross between the Joker and Deadpool I was hearing, and just hearing retailers saying, yeah, you know, these covers are selling, definitely do more with this character. I knew I wanted to have more oxymoron stuff, but just with the stuff on my plate, I didn't really see. I'm like, well, when the hell am I ever going to get to write an oxymoron miniseries or whatnot? And would people come? And so instead, I sort of decided, hey, I'm going to reach out to a bunch of hardworking writers that I know would jump at the chance to tell a supervillain nasty little supervillain story. So I produced a little bit of a oxymoron Bible with some reference and some information and some key backstory, but left a lot of room for them to do their thing. And the reaction was great. Just about everybody I asked was down for it. And the scripts came in, they were great. And then I got the fun challenge of matching scripts with great artists like Joe. So
who are we gonna see? Who we got seeing on this in this book here? Whose work are we gonna be privileged to read?
Yeah, so there's a lot of good stuff, a lot of talent.
And Jason Charmel,
and Joe. Speaking of Joe, we've got him paired up with Jason Cherumella of The Cape from IDW fame, and he's just wrote a killer script and just turned through it. We've got Mark Poulton, who is currently writing Evangeline for Image Comics, and he's also scripting the new look Savage Hawkman along with Liefeld for DC Comics. And so he's a guy that I've known from boards for a long time, 5-6 years now, and so it's nice to see him starting to blow up a little bit with both mainstream work and then continuing to push indie and creator owned stuff. We've got some comics tribers on there. John Lees is actually he drew the script, or he wrote the script that I'm drawing.
Oh, cool.
So this is the first sequentials that I've done all year.
At any point in time do you go, you did this, you got this wrong, he's my character?
Well, part of my job as editor of the anthology was to even out all of the scripts and make sure that he at least sounded like the same character, and I had to look out for, all right, make sure no two stories are using the same exact punchline or something like that. But because there's not this massive backstory, I've heard of certain people that get on licensed work like a Godzilla or Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or some other licensed property, and then find that they're in a box writing it because there's so many just ridiculous things coming from licensing, coming from Hasbro, coming from here, that of what you can and can't do in your script. And I think the Bible that I gave them was a couple pages long, and most of that was imagery and clips from the Red Ten. So I think I everybody enough rope to have fun with it, and nobody hang themselves with it. So
that was a good. Joe here, you're an artist in one of the stories, but do you have an oxymoron story yourself that you want to write, that you want to tell?
Dude, the character's unbelievably fun to draw. I mean, he really is. Like, it's just such a good design for the character. Like, to have him have this Joker Deadpool mashup, but then have him in this just white suit is just such a cool idea, because you could do so much as an artist and leave it open and let the colorist come in later and, blood splatter and just – really, it's awesome. And as of stories, yes, I do, but I'm pretty sure there are a lot more talented writers than myself that would like to tackle it, especially with the heights the campaign is taking. So I'm sure that – Tyler's dance card will be very full writer-wise pretty soon, as long as we get up to that benchmark goal where we can greenlight the second installment.
Yeah, I want to write a story for Oxymoron, but then again, you want to be able to sell this. So
that is true.
Yeah.
That is true. What would the story be? The smart Canadian? The which way are we going to go?
No, that is an oxymoron right there.
The clean New Yorker?
There
which
you
way
go.
Is it going to go?
The angry Canuck,
the good Mulvey. Which way is it gonna go?
The optimistic New Englander,
Canadian free.
There you go.
Yeah, but it's true, and all the stories are great. And even what's really cool, like when you just look at the Kickstarter page, you see so many different interpretations by artists of the little tweaks about the character. Like, if you don't really notice it, some people draw his face. Is it a mask? Is it his face? You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of cool little I keep trying to say this word all week and I'm screwing it up. Intricacies? But
If we're going to worry about words that you're screwing up on this podcast, we got a lot to go back on.
That's true. We got to edit a lot.
Yeah, we're just going to move on. Yes, I think you said it correctly. I'm not going to try and say it because I'm not going to hang myself.
Nice. But yeah, no, I really liked the design of the character, and I mean, I don't think anyone can argue just the fantastic campaign that Taz ran. Like, he's utilizing everything at his disposal. He's inventing tons and tons of different incentives to have old backers up their pledge, new backers jump on board. I mean, it's almost a clinic on how to run a successful Kickstarter.
It really is. You know, what advice, Tyler, would you kind of give? Like, we've had some people. We did a show. We called it on We Talk Comics. And it was – we called it Kickstarter Our Heart. And, you know, it was basically all four hosts brought one interview. Well, actually, one host brought none. Another one brought two. But anyways, the idea was every host brings one interview from somebody. To talk about their Kickstarter campaign. And of the Kickstarter campaigns that we saw, one succeeded and three failed. And, you know, we tried, you know, talking to them, and they seemed very enthusiastic. But there's a lot of things that I think that make for a very successful Kickstarter campaign. What kind of advice would you give to somebody if they wanted to do this?
Yeah, I mean, and I think the first thing is do your homework. Would be the first thing. Now, Kickstarter's been around a while. Like, it's. I think there's still a lot of people that are just discovering it, and there was definitely a ton of people that are backing the Oxymoron campaign that this is their first Kickstarter backing it. So I think while a lot of people are talking about the Kickstarter bubble or, you know, Kickstarter's starting to get played out, I think actually we really haven't seen anything yet. And I think, although once my campaign launched, I was positive that, oh, wait a minute, everybody's got a Kickstarter this week, you know? So it was a little, you're a little sensitive to it. But I think, you know, doing that research is important. And like you said, you know, you said three out of four were unsuccessful.
Two of them were on, I think of those two were Kickstarter, two were Indiegogo, I believe. Yeah. So,
yeah, I mean, like the stats don't lie, and that's one of the cool things about Kickstarter is that it's so transparent in terms of, you know, every campaign that's out there has a history and adds to the history of Kickstarter, and that these numbers are crunched and they're public, and other sites are doing things with them, and you see when you see stats like 13% of comic Kickstarters don't get a single pledge, like
yeah.
And 50% of all comic Kickstarters fail. Like, that's one in two. That's one in two people that say, hey, I got an idea, I'm going to do this thing, and they just don't even get off the ground, you know? So it was very important to me to do everything that I can to, you know, not fall flat on my face with this thing.
And it almost seems like if you don't have a good first week, you're screwed. Like, you know...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I told everybody behind the scenes that, you know, if you look at, like, the Kickstarter gurus and Kickstarter aficionados know that 30% is, like, this magic number where something like 90% of Kickstarters that get to 30% will ultimately be successful. And so I put it out to everybody else, you know, 30% day one, let's make that happen. That's my goal. And honestly, I really because I think we are starting to see a change with Kickstarter where, as it's matured, where early on, you know, most of the Kickstarters that you'd see were people, hey, I have this idea to do something, but to do it, it's going to cost a lot of money, and I'm not really close to being done. I'm not close to starting, but with a little bit of money, I can start. And that is, if you have a really big audience, That can work. That can be awesome. That can work very well. But I think what other people are seeing is that for the right product with the right story, Kickstarter is probably the best way to sell or at least open up the selling of a product. And I, you know, I was very hesitant to jump into the Kickstarter game, not because I didn't think it was legitimate or not because I didn't want it, but because I wanted to make sure I had the right project for it, because I worry that, you know, you can only go to this well so many times and there's only so much goodwill that you can tap into. But I'm starting to question that and just say that, you know, for a lot of people, Kickstarter might be the best way to sell your product.
Yeah. Did the, you know, people working on this book, did you approach them, or did most of them, they approach you, or how did people get in touch with you?
So everybody working on this book got an email directly from me. I reached out to nine writers first. Mm-hmm. And I didn't start reaching out to artists until I had first drafts of scripts. So the first part was, and Kickstarter wasn't the plan going in. I think, you know, it was an evolving thing, but really it was the Sullivan Sluggers Kickstarter that just absolutely blew up.
And yeah, that was something else. We wanted to talk to him on the show, and you know, I was like, oh, that looks like a really cool project. I go to click on it to see how he's doing a couple days later, and it's like he's gone way past what he needs to do to talk to us. Like, this guy is it went crazy.
Yeah, it was an explosion. But it was so the idea was that, hey, you know, I have an audience that I've built. Comics Tribe has an audience that I've built, and the 20 plus creators that are a part of this all have, you know, an audience that is built. You know, why not have a month long sort of online convention experience where we're talking up the product and making it super freaking easy for anyone that's even remotely interested in this to just say, yeah, I'm down, and pitch $10 for the digital, pitch $25 for the hardcover, upgrade to a artist edition for $35, get a massive amount of swag for higher levels, or, you know, even we just sold, which I think is so awesome, and I'm so thrilled that it sold. We put together a writer's dream package, basically, which is going to be story consultation with me, full editing support from Comics Tribe's editor-in-chief, the artist of their choice. They're going to have four Oxymoron artists to choose from to draw their a full 23-page story. Then at the end, it's going to be colored, lettered, and then another a consultation session about how to distribute, how to get it out there to the public with me. And we sold a big package like that for, you know, a lot of money, but it's still great value for it.
Oh, that's awesome. And you know what? Maybe you might find, I mean, you might find that you discover the next great talent doing something like that too.
Well, yeah. I mean, and the guy that grabbed it, he's the exact person that I was looking for. Someone that's been doing their work, been saving their money, is ready to jump in, but still, you know, still knows they don't know quite as much as they could to want some, you know, want some help with it, and to, you know, get some people that have done that, have rode the rodeo before, and have get some published a published artist to draw their thing, to draw their script. That's starting them with a nice head start there. So
I think Tyler should put more of those out, because that is just like, you know, I have to think, and you guys tell me if I'm wrong, it's got to be at least, I'd say, 50-60% of people who are reading comics want to do them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I mean, and I'm probably even lowballing that just to be safe, but you give a package that literally goes shape your product to be the best it can be, get that issue out and in your hands. And that is literally, for that package, that is a dream come true package to a lot of creators. Because you, I mean, you could look at social media all day long, and all it is people talking about frustration with scripts, or, you know, people who have ran Kickstarters, people who have done professional comic work, just still frustrated that they can't get all the pieces to the puzzle together. And Tyler comes up with this package that says, look, you want to make a comic? We're going to help you make a comic. Just, you know, buy this package. It's genius.
Mark Teixeira, we talked to him here in Calgary when he was here at the convention we had here. And, I mean, here's an established name in the industry, currently working for Marvel, doing beautiful work on Space Punisher. And he talked about how he had a project that, I mean, they published a couple issues, you know, of – what, a decade ago, and he wants to bring it back, but didn't know how, and couldn't get the funding and the publisher. And that's Mark Tech's era, you know? Like, so it really is, I mean, really is an interesting, I mean, we're in an interesting time, you know, and something like Kickstarter offers a lot of potential, but a lot of people, I think, they see the potential, but they don't see necessarily the work behind it. And I mean, obviously that's something that wasn't a problem for you guys, and you know, I mean, how much time do you spend thinking of the different packages? How much effort before your launch Kickstarter was put into that?
Fair amount. I mean, but that's the most fun part. you know, the coming up with the using some game theory and you know, making it like, I think anybody right now, anybody can put something online and sell something online. And when you do that, you've got a transaction, you're selling a transaction. But what Kickstarter allows you to do is your campaign, it's a campaign. And campaigns are about storytelling and about you know, drama. And I think one of my goals of how I wanted to run the campaign is I wanted to instill some storytelling. So, you know, one of the unlocks that we did was I unlocked, and this was all credit to Paul Allure for making it available to all backers, but he self-produced a anthology of stories with a bunch of working professional artists on his own. They were all short stories of his own work. And he ended up sending that full printed copies of that work to just about every editor that he's read books by that he liked in the industry from all the major publishers. And a year later, he's got his first licensed work and he's breaking into comics. And the fact that he put that copy into my hand, is the reason he's on the he's writing a short for the Oxymoron, anthology. So I was able to share that story and also share that full PDF with all the backers on the Oxymoron. And just be, you know, the story there is, hey, this is what breaking into comics looks like. This is, you know, you want to know how you do it, you do great work and you make sure people know about it. And so there's stories there to tell. And I tried to also, you know, instill some sense of surprise and mystery. There's still some unlocks that, at certain pledge levels coming up that I haven't announced what they are. And we just announced what will happen at 14K, which I think is just awesome, is that artists at 14K will be able to have a series of up to 10 Oxymoron hardcover variant covers, meaning all of the artists, if they so choose, can have their own variant hardcover, which I think is just a phenomenal thing. Because, you know,
even though we all know everyone's going to want the Joe Mulvey. I hate to interrupt there, but everyone's going to want the Joe Mulvey cover.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, hey, I'll tell you, I still think Scam Number One is one of the great covers I've ever seen.
That's very nice of you to say. I mean, honestly, we are co-hosting with each other, so I do feel, you know, like that's, you know.
Slurp, slurp, slurp. But no, seriously, that, I mean, it is. It's because that cover, not only does it show a character with, it shows your art style immediately. Anybody who sees it goes, okay, this is what the art I'm going to expect from inside is going to look like. It gives some intrigue, but it gives the personality of the book, you know. You see the name Scam, you see that image, you know, the whisper. It just works immediately. I think that's what a cover needs to be. It's not just make it look pretty, but make it look like, give it a hint as to the personality of what's inside, while still, you know, while still making it unique and memorable. So I think that's, I really do think that's one of the secrets for why Scam was successful, was just that image really, really worked to sell the book.
Yeah, man, thank you. I appreciate that. That's also a big credit goes to Tyler, because a couple times before we launched with the micro distribution, I was kind of, I don't know if I was saying cold feet, but I was like, maybe it's too static, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. And we had an alternate version, and Tyler was like, no, I think we should stick with that, so.
Well, you know what? It's brave. The way, honestly, it's a brave choice as well. But I mean, that's a good thing.
When you think Joe Mulvey, when you think Tyler James, when you think Comics Tribe, when you think any man in his right mind or woman who wants to get into comics, bravery is key. Because you have to nut the fuck up to be in comics. Let's be quite honest.
Yeah, bravery, stupidity, you know,
it's all the same.
Skills.
Yeah. Severe head trauma in your past at some point, it helps.
You know what? Have you had anybody who, since you've done this, you talk about Volume 2, have you had anybody who contacted you now who you went, oh, man, that – I mean, I'm not looking for names unless you want to give them. Is there anybody who you hadn't thought to contact who's a, you know, established name who's given you some sort of hint that they like the Oxymoron character, like what they're doing, and want to maybe contribute at some point?
I mean, there's definitely been people that have already let me know that if there is a volume two, they're ready to pitch. Just say the word. And it's been nice to have a number of pros back the project and give retweets and stuff like that. But you know, hopefully they'll get the book and they'll read it, and then they'll say, and then they'll be more receptive to giving us something for and pitching in and being a part of a volume two if possible.
That's cool.
Or even a scamthology, which we may
try. Ooh, nice! I like that.
That would be something.
I like that. You know what? I mean, we're obviously gonna. I mean, if you guys are doing one, I'm writing a story on Pint. I'm Team Pint. I've said it before. I'll say it again.
Dude, I can't wait for you to see the second.
I can't
issue.
Either. I yeah. can't either. So let's.
It's really a hell of a coming out party. But all right, let's get back to the Kickstarter. I have a question for you guys as backers and as comic fans not involved in the process of it. What is it that you guys like to see when you see the incentives? Like, what is it that makes you kind of go, oh, that's something, or oh, that's nice, to, oh, man, I need to have that?
That's a cool question. Keith, I'm going to let you jump in on that first, and then I'm going to...
The first thing is always, where's the starting value that I get a hard copy of what's being produced? And this is something I've seen as a complaint about Kickstarter programs is people who are doing, you know, single issues, that, you know, $10 or $15 is the lowest value that gets you the hard copy, right. Which is a lot for a single issue if that's what you're looking for. But yeah, I always go to, like, what's the lowest value that gets me the hard copy, and then I start looking at what are the next few perks that that make that make sense. Like, what gets me a print? What gets me a signed? I think before the show is over, I'm going to change my support level for Oxymoron, because I think that we're going to get the four copies between us. But I love these extras that have been coming in.
Yeah.
For the all supporters ones. But yeah, I think I'll be upping my support level before the end of the show. So that's working.
At least, yeah, that is working. That is working.
But yeah, honestly, it is the hard copy, because it is, you know, I've supported, you know, Tiger Lawyer on Indiegogo, Jamie Palmiotti's work, and I want that thing in my hand. Because my day job is working in theater, and when we fundraise, you want to talk about being able to point at something, and my support did that. And if I have the hard copy of the Oxymoron, my support did that. That's what I can point at later and go, yeah, that happened because I helped.
Yep.
You know, for me, I find myself, I don't know how Keith feels on this, but it's a bit of a strange situation, because we opened up and we did Independence Month. We wanted to do a whole month on Independence, but there was a theme for it. And this was fairly early on, and we talked podcasts is like 16 months old or something like that now. And, you know, I mean, we talk comics is at 42 episodes, and we haven't quite gone yearly.
Their anniversary.
So, yeah.
Their anniversary next week.
Yeah, that's right. Next year will be a year. So, I mean, we decided to do that fairly early on. And you guys were one of the first guys to get back to us. And, you know, leading to kind of the relationship we've established now. And because we did that, and because we did that Kickstarter show, we've done other interviews, we have a lot of small press guys. We're a show that people feel comfortable coming to, and they know that we can give them some sort of exposure, and we want to. You know, but it's also a very, I mean, you don't want to go too far into that as well. We want to maintain a balance. And so it becomes the same thing. It's like, okay, now I'm seeing the Kickstarter, I'm seeing this stuff. Now I have a show, and I can put this support of the show and marketing and getting the word out there to other people, or I can support it with my dollar, or I can do both. And it's kind of a tough balance, because seriously, anybody who comes to me and says, I want to do a comic book and I love comic books and they seem to have talent, I want to support them all. I can't put them all on the show, and I can't financially support them all. So when I see something, I'm finding myself in a very hard position to say, and it's tough to say to not have somebody on the show if they want to come on the show and they want to promote it. So same thing when I'm looking at Kickstarter, I look at it and I go, I want something special. I want something that not everybody is getting. And probably I want something to go in with the other guys that's like, okay, let's get something cool that's a We Talk Comics cool thing that can say we supported these guys for whatever reason. And I can't really tell you what that is for me. Like, you know it when you see it type of deal, you know? But it has to be something that feels like not so expensive that it's too much, but it's something that not everybody is getting that's unique still. But yeah, I mean, it's a hard place for. I mean, what do we do? I mean, we put on everybody coming to us for the Kickstarter. We can't. We just can't. You know. I mean, we have so many people contacting us now for Kickstarter and small press books.
You should do like bring in the wrestling side of your experience and make like a king of the Kickstarter tournament. So the people that want to come on your show and the people that you have to have them compete to tell you why they deserve your dollar. And then at the end, you name a king.
You know what? Some idea off that's not necessarily bad. Honest to God, it's not necessarily bad. And one of the things that we talked about, we haven't had time to implement it, is having some sort of, this is the small press or independent or Kickstarter books that we're supporting right now, and getting little interviews up and rotating that and doing this and that and on the site. I mean, there's lots of things we can do because we really do want to support it. But yeah, again, it becomes for me, am I better off? Like, I look at it from a different way. When I see something, when I see a Kickstarter, I don't necessarily go, okay, I can support that through my pocketbook. I go, okay, is that worth supporting through my show? And hopefully that can do more than just supporting it by myself. Or in the odd occasion, you know, I think I want to do both. And, you know, but again, I also got three other co-hosts and we don't all want to. Like, this actually brings up something interesting. There's a guy who contacted us. He's doing a Kickstarter book. And I think it looks really, really good. And one of the hosts, I don't want to go into too much details here because it's kind of, I don't want to insult anybody. But this is a question for you guys. One of the other hosts said that he thinks that the project looks too self-indulgent. And I thought the project simply looks very personal. And I appreciated that it was personal. And to me, it looked like he was revealing a lot of himself in what he's doing, and it's very personal. But somebody else says that's too self-indulgent. So I don't know where that balance is. What do you guys kind of think, especially with small press and Kickstarter? Do you guys kind of see that as being something that you have to be careful of, or would you guys have an opinion on kind of that argument?
Go ahead, Joe.
You take the lead.
Well, I think one of the brilliant things about Kickstarter is that because it's new and because it's so tied in with the internet and social media and how things do work nowadays, is that the target audience of Kickstarter is people on the internet, which is a much broader, much more open demographic than people in comic book shops that frequent comic book shops. And so, much like a comic convention with a big comic convention, there's a book for everybody. And the cool thing about Kickstarter, which is not so cool about the direct market, is it only takes 250 people in the case of our Oxymoron supporter right now. I mean, we're a little more than that or something. That's all it takes to make a hardcover. And if you had to do that through the direct market only, you're talking, you need at least like 2,000 orders to make it a financially a viable thing. And at the end of the day, you know, even with that, you're going to make very little profit. I think it's a good thing that you guys are having disagreement over taste. And like you said, you know, I'd love to back every single project. And I think the Oxymoron has like three or four backers that gave a dollar. And I'm pretty sure that these are people that just, they love the idea of Kickstarter and they back just about every project with a buck, you know? And, you know, God love those people because it's, you know, it just, any support is good support. I think that's a good thing. For me, I'm a sucker for people, like, I'm a sucker for projects that are either from people that I know and like, and I'll, you know, go to the mat for, And then if I really want it. And, you know, I never met Mark Andrew Smith, and you know, even though I've heard good things, I didn't really know James DeCoe's work from Orkstein or whatever he does. But once that Sullivan Sluggers got to be $35 for a oversized hardcover with a slipcase and this, that, and the other thing, I'm like, that's just a damn good deal.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And it was too good. And you know what? That was the same attitude that a lot of people had. And that was, that's the brilliant thing about Kickstarter now, is that it's not just about getting your platform and your mom and your girlfriend and your cousin, who doesn't read comics, but, you know, feels sorry for you to pitch you some money. It's about attracting real shoppers that are saying, I want that. And one of the baffling and awesome things that I've found with Oxymoron is that I'd say and they give you a ton of data when it comes to seeing how your campaign's running. So you're seeing where people are coming from, who they are, how, you know, what the average pledge is, what their path's through. And one thing that I've noticed is, and stats is that, a good 45% of the dollars pledged are coming through Kickstarter itself and not through my own platform or through external reviewers. It's people that are shopping on Kickstarter and choosing Oxymoron. And that's something that I wasn't expecting. I was expecting that I'd have to really mobilize my entire platform for this thing to have any kind of a chance. And, you know, God love mom. She's getting her Oxymoron t-shirt and everybody else, but there's a lot of new faces and a lot of new people that are, have latched onto this campaign. The other thing that surprised me, big time international, support of Kickstarter, which shows me that the traditional comic market is just underserving international, and they're turning to things like Kickstarter to get cool books and cool products. So that's another benefit that's just saying, hey, you know, this Kickstarter marketplace is real.
You know, about probably about 8 months ago, I had a period where what I was picking up and trying to read was almost exclusively books from the European market, because I wanted to talk about it as a topic because when we had difficulty, but just the idea that we're in a new age where the way to ship and receive and have books is different than ever before. And a lot of these type of books, these great books being done in Europe, these fantastic books that nobody over here sees. And it probably is, like you say, it probably is the other way around too, is that a lot of the smaller press stuff here probably hasn't gotten over there either, and now is a chance.
Yeah, well, don't you guys think, and I mean, overall, you with Kickstarter, no matter what, you're making a product. And I think the mistake, and trust me, Tyler ran this entire campaign. This is just opinion. At a certain point...
Which is like an asshole. But go ahead.
It's always an asshole. Right, yes. But you should just... we just got to get a sound alert that says asshole as soon as I say anything that sounds like my opinion. But...
Or anything that sounds like you, but go ahead.
Yeah, so every Joe Pesci movie from Blockbuster is going to be fucking shut down. But my point is,
Blockbuster's already shut down.
You can, is it? I still have it here. I'm still getting things for like half off.
Oh really? Yeah, I know. They've been gone here for, they've been gone in Canada for a while. There used to be one in every corner.
Free VHSs though.
Yeah.
But the point is like. You can go and approach Kickstarter as a retail or distribution method for yourself and have a product, or you could go there to seek funding. In this case, the Oxymoron book is pretty much done. It's about getting it to people. It's about getting it to the comic fans. And I think overall, and I mean, I hope I'm not insulting any North American or, you know, people, but I really do believe that, like, Europe – And specifically also Asia, they have a greater appreciation for sequential storytelling, and that's just known. You know what I mean? It's not that it's not really, again, and I don't want to get it on my horse. It's not advertised here.
You know what?
It's not really.
When I was looking at these books, there's no question that I think a lot of we talk about the innovation and the new storytelling techniques and just the different type of not necessarily boxing yourself into the superhero this or that thing. Like, just absolutely, they come at it from a completely different, very innovative and very, you know, I think that some of the best talents working out there are working and not being seen by North American audiences, being seen in Europe, no question.
Yeah, I mean, and also, let's just talk about comics for a second. Comics are the most innovative form of entertainment we have.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because it's original idea for the most part, and it's executed. You know what I mean? Be it the writer, an artist, the collaboration, whoever's idea it is, it gets done based on that creator's perspective. And I'm not saying every one of them is great, but for the most part, you're having people think outside the box. They're not worried about putting it on TV and movies or wherever. It's got to be, you know, kind of like maybe watered down or it'd be easier to produce. The production on comics, you know, while still expensive for quality, is still lower than that to make, you know, a movie with the same type of things. And when you're putting out a book through Kickstarter, you know, a lot of people that, like we were talking about, like failures, a lot of failures go with the idea of like, hey, I have this great idea, I want to do it, how about you give me some money? You know what I mean? And that's not, I don't think, the way to approach it. And the strength of the oxymoron is showing you all the business sense that's gone into it, which I really just wish more comic people had. Like, you know what I mean? It's not, don't get me wrong, it's an art, but it's also a business. And when you ignore one or put more emphasis on one than the other, you're kind of losing out. And I think that's my problem with Kickstarter. I look through Kickstarter a lot and I'm like, man, I really would like to fund this. But in the back of my head, I'm like, I don't think this is going to ever, you know, see the light of day.
Yeah, yeah. And with the campaign, I mean, part of the reason I wanted to do it the way that I did it is and I see the way I run the campaign and hitting our marks and just treating it like it's there's an era of of inevitability with it, will also make people confident that, hey, you know, this is actually going to happen. This is a book that's actually going to get in there. And I do see a lot of Kickstarters that I look at, you know, what they're offering for rewards and what they're saying they need the money for and everything. And it's like, you know, you're going to be out of money before the book is even finished. And then how are you going to print with what you're asking? And you know, I did a lot of, you know, I worked the spreadsheets. I went to my local post office. I ran a ton of numbers, and I would have loved to have our initial goal be much lower than the 8,500, just, you know, to make it easier to hit and to get to that, you know, point where we're guaranteed and the pressure was off earlier in the week. But you know, I didn't want to get saddled with a best case or a worst case success scenario where, you know, to actually the costs of print and shipping and everything, weren't factored in. And so, yeah, so it was important for me to take that and factor all those variables into this thing. And I think I did a pretty good job, of planning things out to and estimating where we'd need to hit. We actually, like, I said going in, we'd need to get to 250 backers to actually to get to our goal, and it actually only took 217. So I was happy to overestimate that.
Now, like I said, just to go back to this, where is the line when you're asking people on a Kickstarter and say they're asking them to support you? Where's the line between being indulgent and being personal? Do you guys have any idea?
It's tough, and everybody's got different styles. I mean, I the one thing that I just wasn't gonna do that I've seen people do, I wasn't going to, you know, do, hey, at comic creator that I don't have a relationship with, please retweet my Kickstarter.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't gonna do that. And in fact, like, all of my tweets around the Kickstarter were to initially, hey, announce that it's here, and then announce what's going on about it. And I've tried to keep the number of tweets down to, you know, what's new about the story, as opposed to, I have a Kickstarter, support my Kickstarter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and that was one of the things with the design of the campaign was just say, you know, let's unveil stuff over time and make it all linked to performance and have a story to tell for 30 days because it is a marathon, man. Like 30 days is a lot. It feels it's half over now, but it feels like it's been going on for a while. And then on the one hand, and on the other hand, you know, it's gone by fast. But yeah, so it is a tough thing, and you definitely don't want to get to the point where you're turning people off, and all of a sudden people are I'm tired of hearing about this Kickstarter. I'm getting rid of my pledge.
Screw you know, I'll tell you, Tyler, I'd be happy to retweet for you if you need me to, especially now that you know you're no longer blocking me on Twitter.
Twitter.
Well, you
Twitter
better stop sending pictures, Mo. That's your problem.
Yeah, Twitter has a mind of its own, Mo.
Yeah, it bullshit.
Knows what's best for me, but I don't know.
Yeah, no bullshit. You did it. Yeah.
Listen to me. Right. To the people who don't know who are listening to this, Mo sends emails filled with pictures that says me in my jersey. However, then when you open the email, it's him in like maybe an Oshkosh Pagosh jersey. I mean, the thing barely covers his neck. It's really, really off-putting.
Yeah, really. So, which is funny because really, if you were to see me naked as like Peter Griffin, all I have is a neck and a belly.
That's true. But, you know, I like how you turned it into a game. What size jersey is he wearing? So then we all email. It's going to be like XL. It's going to be double XL. It's going to be small. No one's won, and the pool is getting quite high.
Oh,
but
it's small, unfortunately. It's
no, listen to me. Don't worry. That's the Canadian air. It thins out the flesh.
There you
Do not
go.
Worry.
There you go.
But I have a question for Tyler, actually. I meant to ask you if you think doing this Kickstarter, and obviously it's a success because you're funded. We're funded. It's funded. But do you think that your experience with retailers before this and the comic market has kind of helped to shape this entire thing, or is digital an entire different beast? Because it's pretty much, honestly, by digital, I should say, I mean, this is a completely social media type, you know, type of retail. Because you're doing this all through a website, through Facebook, through Twitter, through emails, through you know, any people that follow you. Whereas you're not literally having something to show people, like, you know, a book you can put in a store. So, like, you know, do you think this is just, you know, another tool that you've learned on how to promote, or, you know, whatever? I mean, my question's starting to run away from me, but, you know, do you think you've learned a whole new way of marketing, or past marketing has helped you?
Well, no, I think if you've sold a comic book before, you're probably going to have a better shot at having a successful Kickstarter than if you haven't. And so I think my convention experience and really the kind of thing that that's the special sauce of good Kickstarter campaigns is it's really those higher level pledges. And that's also the special sauce of doing well at conventions. You know, if the only thing you sold at a comic convention was a floppy comic book that you printed for $2 and you're selling for $4, you're never going to even make your table back, let alone make a profit or even break even. And so what do you do? Well, in addition to the book, you sell things that are a little bit more limited or like limited edition prints that have higher margins on them. Or you sell artist editions that have original sketch that satisfy the needs of both, you know, comic fans and collectors and people that want, you know, that are art lovers. And you sell, you know, variants that have some cool factor to them. And you find and then you package different things together to create a great value for readers. And what Kickstarter allows you to do easily and conveniently to the mass public is to sort of replicate that convention experience. And that's something you like. If we were just selling the Oxymoron hardcover through the big national distributor, you do have the option. You know, you have the benefit of you've got 4,000 retailers with accounts that you're putting the book out to. But all you can sell is that book, and you're selling that book at 60% off the cover price, and and the cost of printing that book is potentially pretty high if you're only getting a certain number of orders. And there's a lot of variables at play that are out of your control. And I think Kickstarter put a lot of that stuff back in the creator's control. Now, we're going to release this book through the direct market. But the great thing about it is any sales through there is just going to be gravy on top, because these are going to be books that I'm already going to have. And so, you know, the direct market's going to get their crack at this book, but they're not going to get all of the things that the Kickstarter backers are going to be able to get for being on board and supporting us earlier on. You know, the artist edition sketches, the T-shirts, any of the other bonus incentives. So, but yeah, I think just all of the things that I've done in the past couple of years, especially in terms of how to sell books directly to fans, how to sell them to retailers, how to get the comics media interested, and via press releases and things. All of those, and just understanding who the target market is and making an appeal that's going to appeal to them, were all helpful in designing a good campaign. But yeah, you know, I'm not stopping. Like right now that the book is funded, it's allowing me to reach out to some of our retail friends and say, hey, look, this book is going to happen. We're going to do some variants, and we'd even be open to some store branded variants. Are you interested now? You know, retailers are suspect of Kickstarter for a lot of good reasons, mainly because, you know, they're used to buying their books with nice terms and, you know, in a lot of cases paying for books after they've had the chance to sell them for a little bit, as opposed to paying for books up front and then waiting 4 to 6 months for the book to actually show up in their stores. You know, no small business could survive that way. But I think that's okay. I think retailers should be happy that Kickstarter exists, because there's a lot of cool product that's going to be made that might not be financially feasible from, especially in creator-owned stuff, without it.
All right. I just wanted to see how long an on-running sentence you were going to...
Yeah, no periods. No periods.
And breathe. 2, 3...
The man's got insight. What do you want to say?
No. It was good. It was good shit. It was really good. It was really good. But yeah. So okay. One other question for you guys, as your opinion. What's your opinion on, say, Marvel Comics, you know, DC, bigger guys, going to a Kickstarter looking for funding on their projects?
Well, we've had Top Cow do it this week.
Yep.
That was the big. That was the big news.
They're not big. They're really? You asked specifically big too.
Pardon me, Joe?
I said, I'm sorry, are you asking specifically Marvel and DC, or are you talking about just other publishing houses?
Let's stick to Marvel and DC, because they're the two big ones who the opinion is for sure they don't need it.
They don't. I would be kind of shocked if they went there, but I mean, I you know what? If they went there, I think it would mean that they care about the publishing, so I'd be happy to see it. The publishing end getting, like, you know, some sort of boost, but I can't think they would. I think it would make them look foolish, I think, for some reason, just because, you know, it's something they don't need. So I would say that, you know, if you've got that, you know, a little piece of that $600 million that Avengers made, you know, and here's something that if Marvel or DC is listening, well, not DC, because I know that Catwoman negative influx is still hurting. But how about just taking 1/72nd of the movie money and just advertising comic books? I mean, just do this. I heard a great idea the other day. Take, like, you know, give a code that you could put in and get a free digital comic when you go to these movies for Batman, for fucking for the Avengers. I was talking to someone in advertising, and the absolute disaster of the industry is that we are owning – the comics industry is owning the box office right now, and it has had next to no effect on sales in stores. And that is across the board an absolute fucking disgusting shame. for the entire industry of comic books.
And you know what? Just to, I know somebody who owned a comic book shop when the Batman movie came out in 1989, and he talked about how first thing he did was order extra Batman, lined them up. He had a shop in a mall, and a little strip mall, lined up a bunch of these books, put them out front, and as soon as everybody was passing by, they were picking it up, people who hadn't read it in years. But I know it gave the industry a boost and gave Batman a boost back then, but it didn't, like you say now. But I think the difference is back then, I'll just say this, Joe, I think big difference is, I mean, don't get me wrong, they should advertise it, but a big difference is that was one comic book movie, and we hadn't seen one for a few years before that, and we wouldn't see one for a few years after that. Now there's so many a year that people are numb to where the source material is coming from.
Yeah, but you know what? In the same respect, if you get 10 readers out of every, 200-seat multiplex that go in there, 300-seat multiplex, if you get 10 readers to give it a chance, you still breed another audience for the medium. Whereas right now, you're not. You're not even trying to. And right now, as a company who is a publishing house, you have to want to put something in front of them. It costs you nothing. Your digital comics already made on Comixology, on whatever the Marvel – I think Marvel has its own app. It's already done. Go into this movie theater. On your ticket, it'll say, hey, if you like this, here's a code for a free download.
Mm-hmm.
A download. Everyone's on the computer. I agree with you that not everyone's going to go to a store. Not everyone's going to find an LCS or even have one near them. But you have the – everyone's on a smartphone. Everyone's on a – I mean, Apple just said – what did they sell? 17 million or something like that, more iPads this year? Like,
I think that was just during the course of this show.
It's possible. But, I mean, the truth is, it's out there. And there's got to be – you got to try to monopolize on this somehow. Instead of selling – pajamas out the ass with Iron Man and the Hulk on it, try to move the books. Or at least come out and be like, look, we know the books to us are not where we want to spend the money. But I mean, to the people who see the possibilities and the promise and just love the art form of comics, it's constantly annoying to watch.
Keith, since you're you just came from San Diego Comic Con, I almost have the sense that, and you can, because you just came from this, you can weigh in on this. I almost get a sense that the San Diego Comics Con nowadays could not be any less about comic books.
I completely disagree.
Okay. Because they had the cast of Glee, and what the fuck do they have to do with a comic book?
I would say.
Or a good anything.
Sure, Blue Water did a Glee comic, so, there you go.
I would say that San Diego Comic Con is like two or three different conventions all happening at the same time. One of them is the famous people at famous people parties that you will never get near a convention, that doesn't happen on site. You have the Hall H convention, which is the TV and movie people that line up for 2 days. And then you have the actual convention. It was an odd experience because I had the same experience at San Diego Comic Con that I had when I was in the Louvre seeing the Mona Lisa. Everyone had told me before I saw the Mona Lisa that it was very, very small. And everyone had told me that San Diego was not about comics anymore. I went to the Louvre, and the Mona Lisa is like 15 by 20. It's not gigantic, but it's a decent size. And everyone had told me over and over it was small, that I'd expected something like, postcard size. I went to San Diego, and I spent the entire weekend hanging around the DC booth, getting sketches done, seeing Scott Snyder was there every couple of minutes, trying to climb over the Marvel booth to look at stuff. I got autographs. I talked to independent creators. I dug through back issue bins. It was absolutely a comic convention to me, more comics than were at the Calgary Expo this year. And I know Hall H was happening. I know the True Blood folk and the Twilight folk were there somewhere, but I never actually saw the lineup because I didn't care. That was the other convention that was going on at the same time.
Okay. Now, Keith, just to the opinion on DC and Marvel using Kickstarter, I'll just get you, and then we'll go to Tyler.
I'm inclined to agree that it would have to be a very specific thing, and I think that Kickstarter doesn't quite work with their model. To me, the way to use something like that would be to take one of these characters that's been sidelined, that has developed a fan following, Stephanie Brown, for example, because that's the most vocal fan following of one of the lost characters, and say, okay, well, we need to pre-sell Stephanie Brown Earth One graphic novel in order to make it happen. But we need to raise, $50,000. And that's what you do. And you do it as a pre-sale. DC and Marvel may just have a legal problem with their deal with Diamond. That gets away from whether they should or not, or they may not even be able to.
Yeah.
But certainly they can do things digitally that don't involve Diamond. So there's some loophole there. But getting that business end into something like Kickstarter, I mean, it's a fickle and cynical crowd to start. Certainly I found myself looking at some projects and going, $10,000 for a single comic, for a 25 page comic, you're never going to get there. So, and for someone like a big corporate, I mean, you look up some of the stuff on Top Cow. Top Cow's not a big company. Top Cow's not even a company at this point. And the cynicism about them going to Kickstarter. They magnify that 100 or 1,000 times for someone like DC to go.
Yeah, I mean, I think in addition to the retailer just absolute pummeling an outrage that would come there, whatever Diamond distribution deals that are exclusive deals that are in place. And then also, I just can't see a Warner Brothers or a Disney saying, yeah, let's give 10% to 5% to Amazon and 5% to Kickstarter to sell stuff to directly to, like, I think we'd see them launch their own initiative before selling crowdfunding directly before they would go through a Kickstarter. But yeah, I definitely think you'd see a backlash, especially as Joe said, seeing as the corporate dollar and might that they have behind them, there's still very much there's the storytelling and equal parts, we're selling things here, but we're also supporting a person or a group to do something special that is a powerful factor involved. And I think that's one of the problems that, I think the Top Cow Kickstarter looks like it'll be successful. It's about halfway there with plenty of time to go. I had a little bit of a problem with the marketing, or at least the comic media, picking up Kickstarter Top Cow's marketing on it and branding of, Mark Silvestri's giving away the future for free. Well, no, he's going to have Cyberforce superfans fund an effort to, offer books at a deep, deep discount to retailers so that retailers can give them out for free. It's a little different when you're looking at the details, but yeah, I think you're going to see more people trying more interesting things and more stuff. I mean, Penny Arcade in the same week launched a Kickstarter campaign to raise $250,000 to remove the top banner ad from their website, and it was successful in a week or less.
Yeah.
So,
but I think there's a little bit of a silver lining to this. I understand, like we spoke about earlier, that people have a burnout on Kickstarter. It does generally show a direct-to-fan-based distribution system that starts to just give an option of other types of distribution, which is what comics need. Again, I know I can pound my chest about how much I want to see comics advertised, but it really does help to have this direct connection to fans, to new people, to Kickstarter junkies, to have a way to go directly from product and producer right to the consumer. You know, and that's an exciting thing.
I'm not so sure if you talk about the media picking up Top Cow doing this. I'm not so sure that if DC or Marvel got on Kickstarter and did a few projects on there, that wouldn't just create more awareness to more people who never would have looked on Kickstarter, who now might see Oxymoron, and you might actually get a bump from it. I'm not sure in the end it wouldn't actually be a positive. It's much like, back when it used to be that there was, 15 comic books stores in this city compared to 5, there was much higher sales. Why? Well, part of it was simply that there was more brand recognition, more recognition for the product it existed. I'll remember I used to work at a store. It was a health food store many years ago. We were in a mall, in a very busy mall. We're doing really well. And in the same mall, through a loophole in our contract, this stated exclusivity, another health food store opened up, and we thought it would cut our sales down in half. Instead, it actually gave it even more of a bump because people would come there looking for that, and then when they couldn't find it, come over to us or look for different sales, and again, just more brand awareness. So I'm not 100% sure it wouldn't be a good thing if a DC or Marvel did go.
Oh, Kickstarter would love it. Kickstarter would absolutely.
But I'm not so sure it wouldn't be so bad for you, or it wouldn't be a good thing for you too.
No, and part of the reason there is the more people that have done, like, the hardest thing is that first adoption, that first backing, because you got to make an account, you got to sign up, you got to do all, there's 4 or 5 steps that are involved in backing your first project. But once you've backed your first project, the second one's a hell of a lot easier. It's 2 or 3 clicks, and most of those are around just figuring out which prize pack you want to, or which pledge level you want to get. So no, I definitely think you're right. You know, the more and as I've seen with the Oxymoron is that the Kickstarter campaign and Kickstarter community is actually a real thing, that there are people looking for comics to buy on Kickstarter. So the more of those there could be good. You hear some backlash, but I just generally don't think it's a zero-sum game. I don't think people buying Scam are not, that means that they're buying one less book from somebody else. I don't think people treat their content like that. I think, and in general, at a convention, the more people that are selling and selling well, and entertaining fans and having a great time, the better the environment, the more people are going to come back, the more they're going to tell their friends, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and the more sales for everybody. So, I think you have a point there.
Now, here's something else. I know, I'm sure Keith probably knows this to some degree. I'm not sure of any. Has DC or Marvel, for instance, ever sold exclusive products on, say, eBay?
Not that I'm aware of.
No, they've started to, some of them have started to sell things directly at like a San Diego, and retailers have bitched about that, whether it's be, exclusive variants or toys or whatnot that you can only get from the retail booth, because then it's sort of like, their publishing partner is now being their competition from a sales point.
Retailers always seem to have a chicken little, the sky's falling attitude, and never can see the positive out of, like I say, more brand awareness of what's going on out there. They just, I mean, I don't know. I think it's a little frustrating.
I would say, wait to see what retailers you're talking about, because there are a lot of retailers out there that get where comics are hopefully going and get the potential in them. I mean, I was just for 4th of July out to Maximum Comics in Las Vegas to promote Scam. And, I mean, they have 2 stores. They're opening a third. You know what I mean? Like, they're opening 3 stores in a time where everyone else is losing money. So there is a market to be had. You just have to know how to tap into it. I think you can't be the retailer that expects the books to sell themselves, because, comics don't. Obviously, again, I know I keep repeating myself, but they don't advertise. So if you're not going to be willing to take a chance on some books and put them in people's hands, you've got to be a salesman. You can't just kind of sit there. So the retailers who think the sky is falling, maybe they just don't know how to push comics.
I'm gonna ask you to a question. Actually, go ahead. Go ahead. You seem to have something to add there, Tyler. Was that Tyler?
I just got an email from Jetpack Comics, who is gonna be in for an Oxymoron variant. So clearly, that was good timing because there are retailers out there that are seeing the possible advantages, and so yeah, so we're gonna make that happen. But yeah, I think one of the things that we found with our first go around and just getting the initial orders for Scam and do that stuff is that, you know, we still got a lot of work to do and a lot of awareness to build for Comics Tribe and for our books to really make a dent there. So one of the exciting things about Kickstarter is that, like, it's allowing us to be successful in this aspect, which hopefully we can, you know, if this thing continues to build, well, some of the overage funds are going to help us push other endeavors with Comics Tribe and push the books in the direct market as well. So, you know, it's an exciting time.
Okay, now I know it's getting kind of, it's a little past midnight now at the East Coast where you guys are. You okay to keep going for a bit?
I'm fine. Midnight is what I call a gentleman's 8 p.m.
Okay, I just want to make sure. I don't want to, you know, just because I have a couple questions left. I don't know what Keith has going on there. Really, what's he contributed? Yeah.
Look, we can make this a two-parter. You know, people don't have to listen to this all at once.
We could, but we won't. But, no.
Editing?
Do you have a Sunday to kill? Listen to this. Listen to episode two.
Exactly. But a couple questions for you. Now, number one, I just, you know, you talk about the variant cover. Here's, I'm going to throw something at you that's a little different. For each of you, I don't know what book, obviously for Joy, it'd be for Scam. Tyler, I mean, he has a few books out there that he's worked on. If you guys were to take one of your books, whatever book, Scam, number one, whatever, and do some crazy 1990s gimmick cover, what gimmick cover would it be? What would you do?
My sense of humor says scratch and sniff. And I would do a Scam, like issue number 5, the penultimate issue. It would literally smell like a sweaty hooker's ass and stale beer. As a fanboy back in the day,
we could just get that from your bed.
Look, what my wife doesn't know is I have parties. Okay. But, no, back in the day, I remember all the holographic, you know, like, covers where it was like, you know, like Capullo's X-Force. I remember and all that stuff.
Yeah.
That didn't get me as excited as those stupid Ripclaw Wolverine ones where it was like, you know, you just, it was pretty much a matte brown, but it had like claw rips, and then you opened it up and then there was a gatefold cover in there. That would be my pick.
That'd be your pick. How about you, Tyler?
Yeah, I mean, I the Rub the Blood famous Bloodstrike number one cover, I thought about doing something like that for Oxymoron. Really, what I, like, if I had you know, if I had my druthers, the release of the Red 10, every issue would be polybagged because somebody's dying in it. And,
oh, yeah, yeah.
And it would,
polybag is great.
That, you know, also, what? That would totally have fit if you had done that. Yeah.
And it would also include a little, so that, you know, in the Red 10, there's these statues of all the characters. And as they die, they get marked by somebody, the killer, presumably. And I'd also include a little little white statue of each of the characters in the poly bag. So there'd actually be a reason for a poly bag, as opposed to, you know, just the shameless you know, sales
and, and collectible black armbands like the Superman
death. There you go. Yeah.
Nice. Nice.
Dude,
yeah.
The possibility for marketing the Red 10 is out of control.
Absolutely.
We can't get too much here. All I will say is I was in Disney, literally just got back a few hours ago, and Walt Disney World. And I was online, and I think I emailed or texted Tyler, and I was like, I'm pitching the Red 10 to people, and I was making them feel stupid for not having read it. So, like, these people are in front of me, and I hear this guy say, like, Agatha Christie something, and he's with, like, his teenage kids, and him and, I guess, his girlfriend or whatever, his wife, and he says Agatha Christie, and I go, oh, are you talking about, and then there were none, like, the 10, and he goes, No, why? I go, oh, I'm sorry. I just thought you were talking about the Red 10. And then he goes, what's the Red 10? I go, really? You haven't heard of the Red 10? And my wife goes, you said it to him in such a condescending way that he all of a sudden was like so interested because I was so rude about it. So he's like, no, I have no idea. I go, oh, it's this great like superhero retelling of Agatha Christie's. And then there were none. And the guy's like, oh, man, where can I get my hands on that? All this stuff. Awesome. And then I'm showing like the oxymoron pics on my phone to the kids. And they're like, that's fucking cool. Like, how can I get this? And I'm texting Tyler, I'm like, send me a digital file. What do you like? You know, where is it? I'm like, but it just like the marketability for everything about the Red 10 is through the roof.
Yeah, you know what? You at least you found somebody who had an open mind when you mentioned comic books. You mentioned this and that. Today, I was started a new job a couple weeks ago, and I was with a guy who's very, very high up in the company, helping him do something, and he looks at me because Brett from We Talk Comics works in the same place, helped me get this job. And we had at WeTalk at the convention here, we had a picture taken with Keith as well, with Adam West. And he kind of eyes me, right, this guy, and he kind of goes, so, because he talks like that, goes, you know somebody down there at work, or what's the deal? And I go, yeah, and I know Brett. He goes, oh, so that was you on that computer. You know, yeah, with Adam West. He's like, yeah, so that comic book convention? I'm like, yeah. How was that? And I'm like, it was pretty good. It was a little busy. He goes, you never catch me down there. I'm like, all right, well, thank God for that. I wouldn't want to get into a fight down
there. Yeah, but I'll see you at the convention like down the block. Like,
oh, no, I brought up to him. I said, you know what? This is not the weirdest convention there. Have you heard of BrodyCon? Or, yeah, I guess, Brody. Yeah, is it BrodyCon? BronyCon. Have you guys heard of that?
BronyCon, no. Yeah.
BronyCon. It's a My Little Pony convention. They had 4,000 people in Philadelphia for it on July 1st. And it's for adult fans of My Little Pony. So I said to him, that convention's not that weird. You should see BronyCon. I said, BronyCon, what's that? It's like for adults. If you're an adult fan of My Little Pony, the cartoon, it's like 4,000 people went to it in Philadelphia. He goes, really? None of them work, do they? I'm like, probably not.
Guy you work with, did he used to be in the Legion of Doom?
Something like that. He sits there and he goes, round them all up, get the police down there, round them all up or shoot them all. Fucking diddlers, every single one of them. Fucking pedophiles, gotta be.
Okay, could we have him on What Do I Really Know About Comics? Because this guy would be stellar.
This guy was – earlier in the day, he sits there and he says to me, he goes, think about buying an Android tablet. I don't know if there's any difference between the 2.3 and the 3.0 operating systems. I go, the gingerbread and the ice cream sandwich? He goes, gingerbread and ice cream. I know they call them that, but what are, like, fags making these for us or something? I'm like –
this guy sounds amazing.
he's unbelievable.
He's radio company. Gold.
Yeah, I know. He's like one of the highest guys in the whole. And this is a big company. Very six. I'm like, wow, I just can't believe this. And I said to him, yeah, I don't know how they come up with these names. He goes, can't they have like lion or tiger or something like that instead? They could have snow leopard if they want to make one a little more girly. And I'm like, are you kidding me?
I mean, you know what it is, though? Like, especially for comic fans, you just got to have your confidence.
Yeah, I guess.
Like, I'm literally 3'2". I have no idea where my confidence comes from, but I don't care.
I heard you being cast in the redoing that they're doing of Leprechaun. That's going to be you?
First of all, don't tease me. I'm still waiting for a callback. But I really just believe that, you know, like a lot of comic fans, like you hear this thing of like them being shy. I love the comic fans that are just like, fuck it, I'm a comic fan. And especially I live in New York, so it's not the biggest thing. You get on a subway, at least one or two people are reading a comic, like, or at least like on a tablet or something like that. Like, you see it daily. You know what I mean? Whereas like, you know, if someone came up to me and like, ah, you're reading a comic, I'd be like, yeah, fuck yeah, I'm reading a comic. What are you looking at? You know what I mean? But that's why when you say, yeah, that's a fucking, that's right, that's a picture of me with Adam West. And Burt Ward was under the table. We were doing things. Don't worry.
Wait, man, I got on a plane last week, and there was like half the people on the plane were reading graphic novels. And I'm like, this is so awesome. How did this happen? That, oh, wait a minute, I'm coming back from San Diego. Everyone else is free.
Let me tell you something. Just because I know we're running late already, but I just want to say – to Kristen, the JetBlue stewardess, who I called the C-word right about five hours ago.
Story. Give us the story.
I just want to say fuck you in case she's listening. Oh, that's all I want to say.
Probably is, but we need the story. What happened here?
Myself, tender-hearted, silent as a mouse, Joe Mulvey, is on the plane with my wife and my child and my in-laws. We're coming back from Disney. We had a little bit of a delay in the flight, and then we were on the tarmac. We were in the plane waiting to take off for like 45 minutes. And this nut job stewardess was as crazy as I've seen. She just sat there constantly, like she was triple and double jointed in her hand. So she was doing all these like tricks. And then people are like looking at her, and we were right up front because we had the leg room for the baby. And we were like asking her, like, when are things taking off? And she's shushing us and saying, please be quiet. This is good luck. So now I'm like, what the fuck? What do you mean good luck? Like, why do you need to do good luck? What's going on? It's a 2-hour flight. Like, you know, you could put us in the water and we could pedal. We'll be there. And anyway, my kid goes to sleep. It's, you know, 6 o'clock. I have an eight month old. And my kid's good, thank God. And she comes over and goes, do you guys want anything? And we're like, no. And she's yelling. We have the baby. And I'm like, no, we're good. And we're whispering. She literally leans over. Now, my wife is sitting next to me by the window with the baby. I'm in the middle. My mother-in-law is to the right. She leans over so that her face is right at my wife's face and her shoulders are in front of me and goes, how about for you, Mama? Wakes the baby up.
Oh, my God.
To which she walks away, and I'm like, what the fuck is going on? I'm like, is Jamie Kennedy, is Ashton Kutcher on this plane? This has to be a fucking punk. This has to be. So then my wife like looks at her and goes, oh, calm down. Like, you know, there's nothing wrong. I'm like, lady, what is fucking wrong with you? She goes, I'm here to service everyone, sir. I'm like, first of all, I'm not even going to get into that joke. Secondly, I don't understand your fucking issue. There's a baby sleeping. Do you think a baby wants a fucking rum and coke? Do you think a baby wants anything? I'm like, what's your fucking issue? So now she gives me an attitude. She, at the end of the plane, we wait for everyone to get off. My kid's asleep again. She has all the seats in the world to go near. Normally, stewardesses wait at the head of the, you know, at the right by the pilot's cockpit to say, you know, whatever, thanks for flying JetBlue, whatever it is. She literally sits next to us and loudly thanks everyone for being on the plane. So my kid's sleeping again. I stand up. I'm like, lady, I don't mean to be rude, but could you please go up there and do that? She goes, you're not my boss, sir. You don't tell me where to go. I said, here's where you don't go. And I'm not your boss. I'm fucking Mr. Common Sense. You don't go and yell goodbye to 200 passengers next to a fucking sleeping baby. I was like, were you born near a radioactive power plant? Like, what the fuck happened? So what she goes, you know, you're lucky you have – she goes, you're lucky you're here with a kid because you really have a bad attitude. I said, ma'am, at least my attitude is from a brain in my head. I don't think you have the same source material. I think you are a fucking dumb moron. Now my wife is getting upset and she's like, all right, come on, let's just get off the plane or whatever. So the woman goes, well, you're an asshole. I go, look, an asshole is an asshole. I go, but you don't even know how to fucking act around people. I go, so we start going back and forth at each other. I end up calling her the C word. She threw something at me and I don't know what it was. It looked like a little plastic plate, but
wow.
We got home. But yeah, but I said, look, I don't have time for this shit. I have to record a podcast.
Most unprofessional. Oh my God.
And that story is why Mulvey will be taking the train cross-country to San Diego Comic-Con in 2 years.
I normally have a great time on the plane. I'm the guy you want on the plane. I make a few jokes. I spend money on fucking bad alcohol. I have a good time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you can't, honestly. That's – wow. That's
– no. Now, let me just ask Tyler one question so we can get back on the point of comics.
Yeah.
Tyler, if you're still there, I don't know if you're asleep. I understand. But
it's happened to you a lot, but usually in bed, right, Joe?
Yeah, but I mean, I'm paying them for their time, so I'd appreciate them to stay awake. My question is, where do you, as a, you know, a comic publisher, where do you see comics going? Because everything you do is involved in comics. Where do you see comics going?
Man,
now, the first thing, Tyler, unfortunately, you talked. What you're supposed to do is go, what?
Yeah, I might have to get up and grab another beer and come back with the answer for this one. You know, I think you're going to see probably a big reboot from a comic company, and then the sister company rebooting again, and then back and forth. You'll see that. That's something that's going to be coming. I don't see that train ever ending. I think you're going to continue to see people like innovate around the fringes and come up with cool stuff. The conventions and comic conventions seem to keep continually growing and growing. And, you know, Joe and I are going to be at Baltimore in a couple of weeks, and that show just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And then New York, now that a lot of that Javits construction is finished, that's going to be the biggest one ever. So, you know, I think we still haven't seen the perfect superhero movie. We've been getting, you know, close, and movies have been getting great reviews and being box office phenomenon. But, you know, I think we will in my lifetime see a comic book or superhero related movie win an Oscar, which will be fun.
Are you kidding?
Am I kidding that I don't think that'll happen?
You do think that'll happen?
I think it'll happen.
I mean, why would you say no? I mean, look at, you know, I mean, we're not talking about, you know, we're talking about comics. Comics are, you can have anything in comics. You know, Walking Dead could have been a movie.
Good funny. I mean, you know what? I don't care how good Avengers is. It's not getting that. But, you know, you're right. When you look at it from the perspective that, you know, you could do if you had done Whiteout well, it could have been.
We're talking Best Picture Oscar, right?
Best Picture,
because we already had an actor.
Yeah, we had an actor.
Was Road to Perdition nominated or no?
No, it wasn't.
Yes, it was. It was nominated.
For Best?
It was.
For Best Movie?
Best Picture, yeah. I'd have to check that, but it was definitely nominated for something.
Huh.
Yeah, well, I mean, either way, I definitely see the potential because, I mean, what's happening right now in entertainment happened 5 years ago in comics in a comic shop. You know what I mean? You want to find out what's cool, go to a comic shop, and then you're going to be ahead of the curve.
Exactly. Yeah, Stuff of Legend. That could easily be.
Stuff of Legend's going to be gigantic.
That's going to be huge, and it could be, I could see that being a Best Picture. You know, I don't know.
I'll put this out there to you guys. I'll also put it out there to, you know, we talk comics fan base. Do you find yourselves more drawn in to books that offer you a universe versus a story? And I'm saying this just because I was going over the top 100 movie list on the flight actually like a week ago going down to Florida, and I saw a lot of the movies, and a lot of them are, you know, or you know, and again, monetarily, artistically, you know, the way you want to gauge success. But my thing is movies that envelop you in or stories that envelop you in a universe or a world that they set up seem to be the ones that carry the most weight or the endurance over time. Lord of the Rings, Star Wars, you know, they're not just telling you a character in every day. They're giving you a whole new everyday status quo. They're giving you a whole new world and a whole new set of characters. And I think the same thing is for comics. That's what works with comics.
Keith, I'm throwing to you first, too. Keith?
I'm trying to parse my answer.
Don't parse it. Don't you dare.
It's a Canadian thing.
Unparson it. Unfucking parson it right now.
That's a Canadian thing.
I don't know. It's hard to say. You're talking about for comics. Am I drawn to a realistic or a...
No, not even realistic, but if you do have if you do have a book, it's a book that has a world that you can lost in. Like, I think that's a big strength of Saga right now for Image. Like, that starts off with a whole world, and you're in it from that first issue on.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Same thing for, like, Fatale, same thing for all these other books, you know, and I think that's why the reboots from these companies are so prevalent, because it's like, look, we have this great world, but sometimes it gets too convoluted, but we still want to welcome you in.
Yeah, and I think that's why I am drawn to, you know, I still am drawn to the DC universe, and I'm drawn to continuity, and it's become a bad word. I mean, continuity's for the big companies has become, you know, a terrible thing to be talking about. But I'm drawn to it because I like that whole world. I like how that fits together. I like knowing how this issue of Justice League fits together with that issue of Batman. And I like books like Earth 2, that it's completely self-contained, but what he's doing there, building a world, is amazing. You know, I put Earth 2 up with Saga right now, with like starting from, you don't know the rules of this world. We're going to tell you a little bit at a time. And we're going to throw a lot of weird stuff at you while it's happening. You know, in Saga, there's going to be a guy that has a TV for his head. Don't get bogged down in why he has a TV for his head. We'll get to that. Because I got other crazy things to show you.
Right.
But yeah, like I think the rules of the world are something that draws me back. You know, when it's a graphic novel, I'm more interested in just what's the story you want to tell me.
Right.
You know, like I was always a big fan of Elseworlds. I just read two great graphic novels over the past couple of days, Underwater Welder by Jeff Lemire and Monolith by Palmiotti and Gray and Phil Winslade art. Both, I mean, Monolith's obviously not a realistic story, but it is it is set more or less in the real world with like one big exception. And the rules of the world are fairly straightforward. It's our world with this one kind of tweak. And that makes it very story heavy. And it was very engaging. I don't know if I would necessarily go back to one of those if it was structured differently. I kind of like the Monolith was a one-off graphic novel, because if they had stretched that story over the same number of pages, four issues, I don't know if I would continue reading. You know, but because I knew this, I've got one story to tell you. It's all in this one book. Here you go. So I think month to month, I'm less concerned with story and more interested in how all the pieces fit together into the world that they're trying to show you.
All right, I'm going to throw it in there. I don't know if you were asking this of Tyler as well, but okay, first off, I'll say yes. I would love it if I found out that Scam takes place in the same world as the Red Den. That'd be great. But besides that, even though I do think that'd be great,
look, I'm just going to say this. It very well may be.
Very well may be.
Very well may be.
Okay. That's the brilliance of Sin City, isn't it? I picked up the very first page, the very first issue of Sin City, in fact, the cover. And immediately I know the rules of that world. And the world and the setting, the story, is the setting of the universe is as much a character in the book as the characters themselves. In fact, in some ways, more so, because it can go on in that series, for instance, it goes on and tells different you know, stories from the same night in the same city, right? But if the city isn't the I guess what the anchor to tie it all together, it doesn't make much sense. And that is the brilliance of like a Sin City, for instance. Or even if you look at a Frank Miller and what he did with Daredevil, even though it was, you know, when he takes Daredevil, he was still in the Marvel Universe, most certainly, but his Marvel Universe and the rules that apply to it were immediately different than everywhere else in the Marvel Universe. But that was okay, because you understood it right away, and you understood the difference, and it came across in the characters and the style and the settings and just the grittiness or whatever of it. I mean, nobody complains that when they read Watchmen, nobody complains that they don't have a before Watchmen to understand where the world is. Tyler?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I mean, I just finished the latest Stephen King book, the Kennedy assassination one. And, you know, it just makes you giddy when here he is, the guy's going back in time, and he runs into characters from the It, or his book It, which he wrote 20, 25, 30 years earlier, you know, for a guy like Stephen King, like only King can pull off like his mythology is stuff that he wrote himself.
Yeah, for sure.
Which is pretty cool.
And you know, I read a book where it was very, he had created a mythology all of his own, and he was giving it to us piece by piece, and it was too much. It took away from the world. It took away from the stories and the characters, because all of a sudden it became just about the mythology, and it became so much that all of a sudden I felt like I had to start to remember what he had talked about before, because now he's tying it all together. And too much is also too much of a narrative on that can actually detract too. So it's a balance, but isn't everything when you're being creative?
Yeah, definitely.
So. It was an interesting moment at San Diego. It was in the original graphic novel panel. And you mentioned about, wouldn't it be cool if Scam and Red 10 turned out to be in the same universe? The reaction from the audience when they confirmed that Batman Earth 1 and Superman Earth 1 are in the same universe. I mean, there's only two stories by these guys in this universe, and there's only two more, scheduled for the next year. And yet it was a huge deal that they're in the same universe.
Well, and same thing. I mean, the Red 10, you talked about how you had the Joker archetype and the detective archetype. Why did you do that? Well, one of the advantages was to take established characters and make a twist on them, right? And make it immediately available. Anybody who has read Justice League is going to pick up the Red 10 and within the first few pages understand who those characters are just by visually seeing them in the name. Without, even though there will be differences in the characters and the powers or whatever, there's that basic commonality. And it's important. I think it's one of the things that makes the Red 10 so good.
Yeah, I mean, there's, smarter people than I have said that, everybody says they want something new and something original and everything, but what people really want, what people tend to buy is something that they're comfortable with and something that, they know they're going to enjoy. And I think, and so with that knowledge in mind, you produce something that's similar, but a little bit different and has its own twist. And that's really, part of the selling hook of the Red 10 is, I'm one of you guys. We share the same culture and the same background and the same interests. And here's what I'm doing with an idea that you guys have probably all toyed with. How would you kill the Justice League? Everybody's thought about. What would it be like if Batman was murdered by the Joker,
I think,
and everybody had to hunt him down.
Hasn't DC Comics and Jim Lee pretty much killed Justice League to me already?
Boo! Come on, Mo. Oh. Look, I'm not going to lie. This new Justice League is not for us, but
it sucks.
That's why it's not for us. I don't really get what's going on, and I buy it, but it's almost like, watching the Katy Perry documentary. Like, I'm going to put it on mute. Like, I don't need the word balloons. Let me just look at the pretty pictures, and I'll just,
You're wanking up to a Justice League there, Joe?
Yes, I am, and that's why my character is the Flash. But, I literally look at that book, and I'm like, this is just, I want to look at storytelling. I want to look at art. I want to look at Jim Lee. And I think after the last one, and this is again, here comes the asshole alert, my opinion, it's just not even that good Jim Lee. Like, it's,
not.
The guy's got many hats to wear and all that stuff. I look for art to inspire me, to like see guys going for the different angle, to know that an artist put in 2 and 3 days of work on a shot. And I'm just not seeing it in that book. I'm seeing so many different inkers that it's just not working for me. However,
you guys are both talented artists, so I mean, you're looking for something different, obviously, or can appreciate something different than someone like me who can't draw a circle.
Yeah, but you still have what you react to.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I believe that there are guys who in comics are phenomenal artists, and then I believe there's phenomenal comic artists where, comics have their own vernacular, and there are guys who, can draw fantastic movie posters, they could draw fantastic likenesses and just great artists all around, but they don't translate to comics and vice versa outside of it. But you have guys that work in comics right now that are just, A-list top of the games kind of guys that I look at and I pour over their work.
We have a major subject we haven't gotten to, and this show's going long, but you know what? It might be split up into parts just because I got something else here now that that I want to bring up and throw to the three of you. Keith, open with you. I can read a book with terrible art, but it's great written, but I can't read a book that's terribly written and has great art. How about you?
I think I'm inclined to agree with you. The only exceptions would be, not that there's a lot of badly written Barry Windsor Smith, but I could see a Barry Windsor Smith. John Byrne, I can last a little while, even with bad writing, but more of his stuff has bad writing these days than good. It takes a lot for the art to get me completely out of it. Usually just if the art's bad and bad storytelling in a way, as opposed to anatomy or style. If it's bad and I can't follow what's going on, that will turn me off.
How about you, Tyler? Can you plow through a book with great writing more than a book with great art?
I think with art, the secret is it just has to be consistent. I mean, you know, you could look at a Peanuts and if it was just taken by itself, and if you didn't know Charles Schulz, and you were Charles Schwab even.
Yeah, another asshole.
But you know, if you just took one of the images, it's like, okay, that's, you know, that could be whatever. It's some squiggly lines, and what's up with that dude's forehead? That's supposed to be a kid, you know, but because it's consistent over time, it works. And the same thing with, you know, you've got the hyper detailed style of a Jim Lee, and then the black and white world building of a Sin City like Frank Miller. But because it's consistent throughout, you know, it just works. So, you know, if the art is inconsistent, where, you know, one panel they've clearly, you know, photo traced some porn, and the next panel they're back to, you know, a freestyle, you know, different look, that can throw me out. As far as the writing, I think it's weird. It's almost like it depends what's on it. You know, I, even though I'm a big supporter of independent comics, it takes a little bit for me to, I need to read a few pages and be confident that the book is well drawn and well written for me to actually get into the book, because, you know, I've seen a fair amount of indie work that's clearly, you know, clearly lacking or needs improvement or is work in progress. So, you know, sometimes with a Marvel or a DC book, you can get pretty far the way in, for me anyway, and before I realize, hey, wait, this is actually pretty bad. You know, like sometimes I give them a pass probably for too long. But
how about you? How about you, Joe? Do you, or I'm sorry, did you have something else to add to Tyler? Or
just rambling?
You're just rambling? Not you. But
well, no, I was gonna say I already gave my answer. Like sometimes, like just for art wise, you know, I'll buy a book that I might not normally find the story to be all that compelling to me, but I really, really like the art. Like, I think for me, a book that, and I got turned around on it. Originally, for some reason, I just did not respond to the writing of Scott Snyder in American Vampire, but I did like Raphael Albuquerque. So to me, I was more dismissing the writing, paying attention to the art and the storytelling, and then maybe just from looking at it a few times, the writing sank in, and maybe also just from reading other Scott Snyder stuff, it made me give it a second, you know, look, and now I'm a you know, it's one of my favorite series. So I don't know, but to me, I have trouble looking at really bad art.
You know, and the thing is, I suspect, I'm just guessing, maybe I'm wrong, but because you feel like you're still, you know, you're new to drawing comic books and you're still trying to master your craft and blah, 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 maybe, Joe, as you go on and feel like you have mastered it more, you'll be less likely to be as forgiving with artists, or, you know what I mean? Like, it might change a little bit as you get your own perspective on how good somebody is or should or isn't.
Yeah, I don't think that's wrong. I mean, honestly, like I know, like I've been tweeting it for the last couple of days. I'm excited. Like right now, I'm probably gonna pass out after we're done with this. But I'm excited to like get back at the drawing table and draw and just really try to produce as well and fast as I can, because I think what you just said is a crux of mine when it comes to my my process. Like sometimes, you know, I rely too heavily on what one little line is going to mean, whereas the story is told, the storytelling's done, move on and go ahead and just put out a body of work more than really, you know, get crazy with semantics and stuff like that. But you're right, it could be something that I end up, you know, switching my perspective down the line.
Yeah, you might and be.
I will just stand up for my boy Jim Lee in that, you know, in the past year, we've gotten, what, 8 or 9 Jim Lee drawn, fully sequential arts, like on comics. So, you know, and that's probably a high for the past 5 or 10 years. So,
yep.
You know, and I think that's good for the comic market and the comic, you know, industry in general to have, you know, your big name talent guys actually that have had a 20-year track record still doing the damn thing. You know, how many guys are out there that are just making all their money doing covers or convention sketches and things like that and haven't bothered with a sequential page for a while? So, you know, I'm gonna give some credit for that.
But let me just say also, and this is with him wearing a ton of hats over at DC during a relaunch, during a whole company restructuring and all that stuff. And I think he just had a kid. So yeah, no, I give the guy credit, but it's just, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's just we grew up when he was at his. No, I wouldn't even say he was at his peak because he's just a phenomenal artist. I'll just say that, you know. It's kind of like, to me, I was going to compare him to, you know, Meet the Fockers De Niro to Taxi Driver Godfather De Niro, but that's not fair. To me, it's just like, you know, maybe it's not what I'm looking for, even though I think Hush was amazing, and some of his stuff is still there for me, but it's just this project isn't connecting, and that's just, you know, that's fine from perspective,
yeah. Well, I mean, you know, like, project to project. You've seen Jim Lee and Scott Williams do everything that they've done it all before. And
right.
And I think, and so when you have someone performing at such a high level for so long that, you know, but fuck, man, if I woke up and started scratching on a page and came up with anything remotely good as Jim Lee on his worst day, I would be tweeting it up a storm and sharing it.
Yeah,
with the
but
world.
You know what, you know how it's like you've all heard a song from somebody where you went, man, that guy's just cashing in. You know what I mean? You all heard it, where you know that guy is capable of more. And he didn't give it to us for whatever reason, being it just lazy or being it too busy or being whatever. When you know he can do more and can be better. That is, you know, I mean, if you've seen how great he can be, why should you expect as a fan to give him money for being less than great?
Well, I will say this, yeah. And hold on one sec, Ty. If you look, it's his anchors that have changed. So maybe it's not him. You know what I mean?
That's
like
true.
He's like you look at like Greg Capullo, who I think is a storytelling master. You look at him when you follow him on Twitter. He shows you his pencils, and they are loose. The acting is there. The storytelling is there, but they are very loose. It's Jonathan Galapion, or I don't want to butcher his name. That anchor comes in. Well, it could be. It's true. But when I'm going to go first name with Jonathan just because I don't know how to say his last name properly.
That's why I call you Joe.
It's a very easy name. Joe and Mo. Show number deuce. When you go and look at the inks that get put on there, it's him that adds those finishing touches, those fine little details, those really nice lines. And maybe that's just something that's missing overall in comics because of, you know, digital inking, going straight from pencils to color. But Scott Williams, when he inks, you know, Jim Lee, that is comic gold. That is comic harmony. That is artistic harmony in comics. It just looks right, and they know how to work with each other, whereas other people might not. So while we're kind of, you know, and I'm guilty of it myself, kind of cutting down on what I think Jim Lee is doing on those books, he's not getting inked by the guy who's always inked them.
You do digital inks. You're doing that on your book, you said last time, right?
I am, yeah. But don't get me wrong. If Jonathan Galavion, I don't know if I'm saying that right. I'm going to say it different each time.
Eventually you'll get it right. You do that. There's only so many versions.
I love the laws of average. It's what I got married on. But if you look, like, you know, like certain inkers just elevate a pencil style. And, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with that being – you know, Scott Williams to Jim Lee. I mean, you know, comics are collaborative. Like, you know, nothing's as good as when you work with somebody to make it better. So, and that's directly related to the art. So if your pencils are nice and loose and that's the style you've been working in for, Jesus H, how many years? 20 years, easy?
Yeah.
So, you know, if someone else starts, you know, touching up your stuff, you know, 20 years down the line, well, if it looks different, you know, maybe it's not just you. Maybe it's the newer collaboration.
Okay, final topic, because we are, you know, I do just want to get this in there, though, because me and Keith, let's say, we have a disagreement on whether or not a book coming out from Image would be considered an independent. And so I'll get Keith to place his argument, then I'll place my argument, and then you two will be the deciding voters. And tell us if we're right or wrong, because you guys know more about being independent books than us. So, Keith, go ahead.
All right. Well, my definition certainly comes from film, what I would consider an independent film. For an independent comic, for my definition, I do separate it from small press. I don't necessarily consider Image small press, but I consider pretty much everything they produce indie. For it to be indie, to me, it has to have no editorial sign-off. It has to have creator ownership. It has to have no advance money from a corporate. That's probably it, actually. Those three things would isolate my definition of an independent comic.
Okay. And my definition is that books coming through Image are not independent comics, because just simply by having the Image logo on their book, they're more likely to be seen by retailers in Diamond previews. They're more likely to be seen if their book is advertised in the back of another popular book within Image. They're more likely to be visible on social media. And even if they only sell 5,000 copies, simply by being with Image, which is the level of an independent book, let's say, simply by being Image, that might have been 500. And so no book coming out from Image, because Image as a publisher's visibility makes it no longer independent, in my opinion, even though it doesn't guarantee that it's successful. So go ahead. Which one of you wants to jump in on that?
If Tyler doesn't mind, I'm just going to go first. That way we can end the show on Mr. Bossman's opinion. But I really think that no matter what, because it's not a cohesive universe, it's just a publishing house that really doesn't pay a page rate, to me, Image is still independent, because it's independent creators coming to a publisher with an idea, and then at that point, they have to corral an art team, corral a comic team to put everything together and then put out the book. So you have a little bit of help in maybe your solicitations and maybe a little bit more directive and a little bit more help in the how-to process of putting the book out. But for the most part, that's, you know, no different than you can now get from, you know, people's advice on Twitter or on Facebook or social media. So to me, I still say Image, while successful at it for many years, they are still independent.
Okay. And I don't know. I was surprised to hear that, because, you know, I know that a book coming out through Image doesn't have to fight for a lot of things that you guys have to fight for. But I understand what you're saying.
They had to fight for that 20 years ago at a different time.
Well, they did, just because they were Jim Lee and fucking McFarlane and
Yeah, but let me tell you something, man. Just because they made that move then with heavyweights doesn't mean it can't be done now. And now is a writer's age.
That's true.
Now is the writer's age in a visual medium. So if you can just get your story together, get it out, get it produced, and have an idea how to market it, you can become a successful publisher. And I really think that's the strength of Comics Tribe and everything that Tyler James, soon to be Comics Mogul in the making, promotes. That's his whole thing. So now, beyond that, let's hear his answer.
All right. Yeah. I mean, now that Keith has made good points and Joe has made good points, and since they're both wrong, now agree with me, Tyler. And
Mo, are you going to change your Facebook picture to the one that says "I heart before Watchmen"? I'm sorry, I don't.
No.
And are you still wearing the underwear that says "Heart the Comedian"?
Yeah, and the heart is, you don't want to know where it is.
No, I know where the heart is because on the back you make a Rorschach every morning, so it's very nice.
Yes, there you go.
Oh, man. I don't know, man. I think I argued this over Twitter.
Tyler, do you realize you're too classy to be on this show?
Hey, I've never been one to avoid slumming it. My college late night college track record with the ladies is testament to that. So
mine too. Thanks to your mom.
Wow, nice mom.
There we go. All right, go ahead, Tyler. Tell them how they're wrong.
I mean, here's the thing. Like, does Image give you an advantage if you're a creator? Yeah, Image is the best place to bring your project if you are an independent creator. It's the best. It's probably the best deal going for creator-owned projects right now. I don't know. I still see those creators as independent creators because Image, as Joe said, they're not giving them any money. In fact, the money goes from the creators to Image first, and Image gets paid first before any of the creators see any money. And most of those creators that are selling 5K or less aren't seeing a dime from it. So that seems pretty independent to me. And also, just while being up in the front of the previews catalog is great and all, it's by no means guaranteeing that you're going to do any damage. And if you really look at the putting Image next to a Marvel or a DC, that's like, you know, putting the military of Iran next to the U.S. It's,
you could have just used the military of Canada.
Or the military of Canada. Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I mean, does it give you a leg up? For sure. The Walking Dead, I think, considering to keep it going, Kirkman had to go deep in debt and in the early days and to really just stick with it when it's selling 9,000 copies. And it pretty much being him that was funding it and keeping it going. You know, it's easy to call it, you know, a mainstream book now after AMC deal and everything. But, you know, at what point did it become the mainstream? And how I think it was very much an indie book for a while. So I don't know. That's again, I sort of side with the Joe and Keith side of things there. So sorry, Mo, you're shit out of luck and dead wrong on this one.
Yeah, that's all right. You know what? I suppose if I look at it from the perspective of, like, part of me and part of it is just that I can't get over the idea of walking into those comic book shops in the early 90s and seeing 250 copies of every single new Image book. But that was a different era, you know. But no matter what they did, I mean, Freak Force number one would come out and have 400,000 copies on the shelf, you know. But it is a different era.
And seriously, there's 500 comic shops out there that buy that stock Image books.
Yeah,
the average Image book. Like you know, there were Image books that there were shops that did not order Saga, for God's sakes.
Yeah,
you know? and so it's still a tough hill battle. Like, and I think it's something that a lot of creators need to understand is that, you know, yeah, it's great. You pitch, Eric Stevenson picks you out of all the thousands of pitches he gets each year. Well, guess what? That your work's just starting.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So,
and I suppose to some degree also you would, I mean, maybe to some degree, I'm sure what Image is now is what you would love to build Comics Tribe to being, but you would still consider yourself independent publishers to some degree, right?
Well, until I create some Watchmen-level contracts and just absolutely rape the shit out of...
You heard it here, Mulvey. Watch your ass.
Yeah, yeah.
Dude, you know, that's how you get in the tribe, okay?
You get your ass raped?
Well, it's...
That's the initiation?
Look, I'm not going to say you get your ass... Listen to me, first of all, you Canadians always assume the worst about us Southerners, but the thing is this. What happens in the tribe stays in the tribe, okay?
All right. Hey, Joe, you sure Thank got you. A pretty mouth.
Oh, it's Joe and Mo show after dark.
All right. I think this show is done. Let's you guys do your plugs. It's all about you.
Yep. I'm going to plug Tyler James. You can find him on Tyler James Comic at on Twitter. On Facebook at Tyler James Comic. I don't even know. I don't have a Facebook page. I'm not going to lie. This one's just me and Wong.
You still don't? You're still afraid of the woman finding you? You still?
Dude, here's the thing. I just can't go on Facebook. I feel like I've had such a rant against Facebook for so many years. It's such a hypocritical stance at this point.
You know you got to. You've been saying it for a long time.
Dude, I'm not even joking. New York Comic Con, I will sign up at the table for Facebook, and I shit all of you not, I will have an email from an ex-girlfriend within I'd say, to be kind, a couple hours.
You gotta film that. Just film that. No, that'll be awesome.
Not even a question. Guaranteed. And once they find out I'm tweeting or doing like social media saying I'm at New York Comic Con, there's no way I can announce the bar I will be at that night. Nah. There's no way.
But it might help sell more books, so do it.
That is true.
That's my publisher hat right there. That's my publisher
hat. Dude, someone came up to me at the last New York Comic Con. They're like, oh, you're one of your ex-girlfriends asked me to pick up a book. I'm like, oh, great. That's great. Can you autograph it? Why? I don't get it. But, yeah, and also if you
As long as they don't ask you for some of your DNA, you're okay.
No, they've already got that in spades. But – I mean, as soon as they went to sleep, I was leaving it on curtains, like, you know, unopened mac and cheese boxes, like just wherever I could, you know, to be spiteful.
Okay, I had mac and cheese for supper, so let's not go there.
Well, you didn't lick the box, so you should be fine.
No, but it was white cheddar, so you never know.
But let's get to Tyler. Let's get away from the semen jokes and talk about a real man. Yeah, so if you want to find out just absolutely consistently on point comic market insights, follow Tyler James. The man knows. He literally is the doctor of the comic market. The man has a PhD in comics. He knows what's going on. He knows where comics are going. And if you're listening to this, you like comics, so follow the guy and get learned.
And you know what? That's excellent. And I would like to say that you just used the sentence. Let's stop talking about the semen jokes and talk about a real man, Tyler James. So
that's it.
Tyler, anything you want to add to that?
Well, definitely check out the Oxymoron hardcover on Kickstarter. We just this second ago got our 241st backer. We're at 12,900. Heading close to unlocking variants. We've got hardcover, oversized hardcover to go. Volume 2 at 20K. So still got 15 days to go. Other than that, yeah, man. Scam, number one. Worldwide debut in about a month.
Super cool is coming up to hopefully get you guys some press regarding that, right?
Yeah, we're hoping. We're hoping. Well, let's be honest. It's definitely going to get press. It's just a matter of we've literally said, hey, we have a really big mouth. Let's put some money in it. And that way the two things can be found in the same place.
Yeah.
Money and mouth are together. So
money and mouth are together.
That's all you need to know.
Speaking of your mom, but anyways.
But yeah, thanks for having us again, guys.
Speaking of your mom.
We've definitely overstayed our welcome.
Ah, shit.
Can I ask you a question, Mo? Are you adopted or no?
Most likely.
Actually, no, I just want to know if someone claimed you. That's I'm just asking.
I was born in this place that was so small. The city was so small in Denmark that there wasn't even a
you
hospital.
You were not born in Denmark.
Yeah,
were you really born in Denmark?
Yeah, yeah. And it was so small. It was like 16 people lived there. There wasn't even a hospital. There was the doctor that delivered me was at an old folks' home. I believe I was likely the only kid there.
Dude, how the hell have we not spoken about that? That's generally interesting. Unlike every other thing you say, that's interesting.
All right. Well, fuck you then. And that's the Mo and Joe Show, episode 2. Are we OUT, Keith?
Well, once I say goodnight. Goodnight, everyone.